microphones are live.
Thank you, Madam Clerk. Good morning, and welcome to the March 10th, 2009 meeting of the San Luis Obispo County Board of Supervisors. If you would please all rise and follow me in the flag salute.
I pledge allegiance to the flag of the United States of America and to the republic for which it stands, one nation, under God, indivisible, with liberty and justice for all.
And Madam Clerk, if you would read the changes for today's agenda.
Changes to today's agenda under amended items on consent is A12, a request by Social Services to approve 1, the appointments of John Meyer, Labor Representative, and Carol Hatley, Community-Based Organization Representative, to the Workforce Investment Board, and the conversion of 2 economic development seats into labor seats. Recommend approval. Staff is recommending this item be amended by adding the letters of interest and resumes of the appointees that were inadvertently left out of the packet. The pages are attached for your approval. Added item on consent is A14, a request by General Services Agency to increase the construction change order limit from 15% to 18% for the Eastside Access Roads construction project, the first phase of the landside development work at the San Luis Obispo Regional Airport. Recommend approval and instruct chairperson to sign. Added item on presentation is B1, a submittal of a resolution proclaiming March 2009 as American Red Cross Month. Recommend approval and instruct chairperson to sign. Staff is recommending this item be placed on the agenda immediately following the morning public comment session. Added items on closed session under pending litigation, conference with legal counsel, existing litigation. 18 is Bookout versus County of San Luis Obispo. 19, Franks versus County of San Luis Obispo. 20, Sprint PCS Assets LLC et al. Versus the County of San Luis Obispo et al. All requirements of the Brown Act have been satisfied as this notice was posted prior to the 72-hour noticing requirement. And those are the changes to today.
Thank you, Madam Clerk. Brings us to consideration of our consent agenda. I have one request to speak, Dr. C. Height.
Height, Los Osos. Okay, A2, request by Supervisor Meacham to reappoint Helen Dutra to the County Commission on Aging. When you make this appointment, I think that it's really important that this individual understand some things about aging, that services that are available to seniors are also available to disabled. And I know that Atascadero and Paso Robles are really ahead of it as far as providing services, housing services for senior citizens. Some places don't recognize that when there are openings for seniors, discounts for seniors, this also includes the disabled. And as the 60s generation ages, it's really important that people understand the specifics of California law, and that's ADA law. And then moving on to this appointment, A2, Carol Hatley, Community-Based Organization Representative. Well, community-based services are in place. This is part of the ADA. It's the Olmstead Act, and it says that when community-based services are in place, you must provide these to keep people in their homes. And I would hope that Carol Hatley has read this. I would hope that she understands that her Los Osos tenants are under duress. I would hope that she understands that tenants have basic legal rights that are always present, no matter what the rental agreement and the lease states. I would hope that she has read this. I would hope she understands that her tenants have a right to not have their door unlocked when they're standing there in their nightgown, that disabled families have a right to not lose their home because they're shoved into a two-bedroom home. And the buck stops here. I would really ask you, this board, this new board, because you can change your reputation. And I'm basing this bad reputation that the county has earned on the synopsis of AB 2594, in which your council and your administrator recommended that you undermine the ADA in California. And I want to read this statement, and it's why it's important that the public knows that this did not pass. This does not count. The ADA is not rocket science. It's good manners. It's just common human courtesy. And what the county voted for was that this bill would impose unprecedented procedural and legal barrier to liability that is inconsistent with federal disability discrimination law and are not imposed on any other protected class under federal and state civil rights. And so the county in the past, it was 2003, voted this, and it included housing accommodations. Marrying housing authority, and I say authority with social services, is very important that people are kept in their homes and work together. Thank you.
Thank you, Dr. Height. Seeing no other requests to speak, we'll close public comment on consent and bring it back to the board. Ask my colleagues if they have any items to pull. Supervisor Hill?
No, thank you, Mr. Chair.
Mr. Shajian?
Not at this time.
Mr. Patterson?
No, sir.
Mr. Meacham?
No, sir.
All right. With that, I have none, and I will look at the consent agenda. I have a motion and a second. And Madam Clerk, we'll have a roll call, please.
Mr. Asajian?
Aye.
Mr. Meacham?
Aye.
Mr. Hill?
Yes.
Mr. Patterson?
Yes.
Mr. Gibson?
Yes. That brings us to our morning public comment period. Since we are going to be having just a morning session today, we will announce that we will not be having afternoon public comment. So public comment for items not on the agenda. The time is now. We'll start with Mr. Dave Rodriguez, followed by Dr. C. Height.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the board. I am representing the U.S. Census Bureau, and I'm here today to let you know that we're about a year out from the census. We're beginning canvassing of neighborhoods in San Luis Obispo County, as well as unincorporated communities. We are striking agreements with all cities within your districts for partnerships so that we can get the census rolling when the appropriate time comes. We're also, remember that the census is extremely important. It's about $1,000 per person if we don't count those people, it's $1,000 per person that doesn't come into the community. So it's very, very important that we do this. Our objective is to hire local administrators and local people to canvass neighborhoods and to begin the process. It's very important to us that people that live in this county actually work the neighborhoods and actually do the canvassing. So we're making a special effort to do that. We're looking probably at about 160 jobs in the area, hopefully. That'll come to pass very soon. So other than that, we look forward to working with the board and with city councils and community leaders in making sure that the census is exact and it brings back the revenue that's needed. And if there's any questions, I'll be glad to answer them. But like I say, this is about a year out, so we'll begin counting. We'll actually begin sending a short form out in March of next year. And those people that don't return the form will get a knock on the door from us. So any questions?
Any questions from colleagues on this? Mr. Rodriguez, are you based locally here?
No, I'm actually from the Los Angeles Regional Office, and we're setting up to recruit and do what we have to in this county.
And Mr. Shajian.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Rodriguez, when you said if they don't return, they'll get a knock on the door, I'm assuming it won't be any scare tactic. It's the people in uniform or...
Very kind, and I will knock on the door, and if people don't answer after the third time, well, that means they probably don't want to answer the call. But we are going to have, hopefully, a number of sites around the county where if you don't want to knock on your door, you can walk into a public building and fill out the form, into a school, fill out the form, drop it in a box so that there's the least public intrusion.
There are certain areas that the approach needs to be a little more careful. I'll be happy to work with you to have a public place to address some of these issues.
Thank you, sir. Appreciate that.
And Mr. Rodriguez, would you be the main point of contact for the county on the matters of the census?
As soon as that person is hired locally, they will be in touch with the board and with city councils.
All right. We'll look forward to that. Thank you. Thanks.
Thank you very much,
very
for,
much
your
for coming. Yeah, and your outreach. Dr. Height, followed by David Dugan.
Dr. C. Height, Los Osos. I had very successful donations to the Hearts of Obispo fundraiser, and I want to point out something about productivity. As a Los Osos artist, every word that I speak, every word of every speech that I write, every moment of my time in this boardroom is literally a brushstroke that doesn't go onto a canvas, a bead that does not go onto a necklace. It is a pinch of ceramic clay that does not go towards a fundraiser. And you're not paying me to be your affirmative action director. You're not paying me to be your human resources director. And I'm giving you information that will prevent you from being sued in the long run. So you can at least pay me the dignity that I come here and I spend my time, because I'd much rather be doing the art and the direct fundraisers. You can at least tell me who your affirmative action director is. I know that when other people come forward and ask questions, make inquiries, you can respond to them. One thing that I've been presenting here today is the fact that the county in 2003 put this on the agenda on a Friday for a Tuesday. That certainly didn't accommodate the disabled when you decided to undermine the ADA. There's only one original board member here. So when I say you, I have to address the board in this manner. You know, keep in mind, don't be defensive, that I'm not talking about the new board members. And you really have a responsibility to speak up. And what your administrator and your council came back with was the idea that you should join in with this bill. And it says this bill is the latest in a series of efforts in California and elsewhere to restrict suits seeking to enforce disability discrimination law in businesses, housing accommodation, and public facilities. And because the public had so little time, and we did nothing to point out that this was really unfair and unjust, well, then the same thing happened to the people of Santa Margarita. They got the same kind of treatment. Because we didn't stop anything way back in 2003, we didn't really have a public forum. There was no comeback to educate the public. Businesses continued to be sued, and nobody understood that just because the county backed this, that it didn't go through. So, I'm going to ask who your human resources director is, your affirmative action director, and do you understand that there should be affirmative action in this county, not just where it regards employees, but when it regards the services that they supply? Because you have an incredible history of scandal, and you could do this today as you could enforce, you could at least look into it, and that's zero tolerance for scandal. You can't afford it. So you could do that today. You could turn to your council and say, gee, how could we educate this public so people aren't sued? Thank you.
Thank you, Dr. Height. Mr. Edge, there was one request in that comment as to how the public might get in touch with the county as regards its hiring practice. I heard that referenced as affirmative action. I wonder if you could help us there.
Certainly, anybody interested can contact Ms. Tammy Douglas-Schutz, who's our human resources director in the county, or they can contact labor relations in my office. Gail Wilcox is a good contact there. And those numbers are generally available. My office number is 781-5011, and I can't remember Ms. Douglas-Schutz's number off the top of my head, but if people call into 781-5011, our wonderful receptionist can route their call to the appropriate person.
All right. Thank you, sir. Mr. Dugan, followed by Gwen Taylor.
If you want to also, last week during the Los Osos issue item, we were restricted to 2 minutes. I didn't get to make my points. About how vacuum was eliminated in the rough screening for a collection system for Los Osos wastewater project. Next week, I'm going to be bringing a DVD with words from staff and as well as people on this board, which leads me to believe that gravity was a foregone conclusion. The vacuum system did not get a fair review. I can show that ahead of time that everything was going to be outed, including step, which I'm not a fan of. I don't think that putting another septic tank in somebody's yard is what people want. But I believe vacuum systems should be recognized for what it is, for every four or five lift stations you have with gravity, you have one vacuum station. That also equates to one backup generator instead of four or five. And as I said before, there it's 3 to 5 feet below ground for installation of the piping, the laterals and the mains. And of course, you know, you cut costs there too, because it's easier and it takes less time to install these things. Unlock cost is astronomically lower with this project, with that type of collection system, the vacuum system. And the more I've been looking at it and looking up online and gone to the websites of the cities and the towns, as well as people who are doing reviews on this system, the more I'm convinced it is the cheaper alternative, way cheaper than gravity overall. I think we could save tens of millions of dollars. I also would, and of course I want to remind you again next week, I'm going to bring in a DVD pointing out all the bias towards gravity. I'm really troubled also that the ponding system was eliminated from the process so early in that the county's not considering ponding. They said it takes too large of a footprint. Well, guess where they're recommending, staff is recommending to put this project? Torrenini site. It's huge. So now there's a big enough footprint for the cheapest alternatives for treatment. In fact, it might say we might save enough money overall to go full tertiary treated effluent. And so I would suggest that maybe sometime before you have to make that decision, that you redirect staff to go look at the vacuum system, come back here and make a report. Make sure that they've contacted the cities and the towns that have and the rural municipalities that have used this system and have been using this system, and get anecdotal information from them. I sure know that during the hurricane seasons in Florida, that they reported zero a loss of service during hurricanes when they use the vacuum system.
Thank you, Mr. Dugan. Mrs. Taylor, followed by Ben DeFada.
Good morning. My name is Gwen Taylor. I'm a resident of Los Osos. Last Tuesday, you were introduced to a group of people from Los Osos who had a support for the project that the county was putting out. I would submit that most of those people have not been in the community for any time, such as reviewing the previous engineering forms, projects, the former engineering processes. We have had Brown and Caldwell, Montgomery, Metcalf and Eddy, Montgomery, Watson, Harza, and it goes on and on. Yet many of those people don't even know what the project is really supposed to do. All they want is get it over with, get it done. They're not thinking about their neighbors or the people who are wondering whether they're going to have any money coming in because their contracts have not been renewed. They have not had their minds set on doing anything but getting it done. People are hurting. People are wondering whether they're going to be able to feed their children because they are no longer working the period of time that allows them to have a full paycheck. We have people who are seniors who are wondering whether they are going to pay for a sewer project, whether they're going to pay for food, or whether they're going to pay for medicine. Because every day you look, the income that they have been planning on to live on is going away. I would hope that this board does not fall into the same, excuse me, trap that the previous boards have fallen into, trying to get a project done fast so that they can put this out and say, see what we have done. We have finally taken care of the sewer project in Los Osos. Don't fall into that trap. Many of us have seen, sat, and been, shall we call it, involved in precisely that kind of thinking. Don't do it, please. The community will be destroyed if you don't take the time to process a project that we can all afford, not something that we're going to have to give up our homes and move out because of your decisions. Thank you.
Thank you, Mrs. Taylor. Mr. DeFatta, followed by Eric Greening.
Morning, Supervisors. Ben DeFatta here from Los Osos. Life is full of compromises, except here in Los Osos. Every day, everything one does requires compromises. What to eat, where, buy, sell. All driven by what you can afford. At home, government, industry, all by what they can afford. We all want to buy an expensive car, a home, eat the best foods, but in the final decision, what you can afford is the determining factor of your choice. Here in the prohibition zone, Los Osos homeowners are faced with the decision of what kind of wastewater process we want to build. There are those that want a Cadillac gravity collection system and those that can't afford a Cadillac gravity system. Instead, they buy a Buick instead or a Chevrolet. Point being, we need a wastewater project, we want a wastewater project, and in order to get one built, there has to be compromises by you, taxpayers, watch people, and others, or we will be going through the same old delays again. Both expensive gravity and BioLacca systems and affordable alternatives will do a good job also. That's all that's required. Why do you care what kind of project gets built? Why does it have to be the most expensive project in the country per capita? Your so-called Taxpayers Watch, in quotes, organization doesn't seem to care of the thousands of homeowners and renters that will have to move out of Los Osos. This don't care attitude of Taxpayers Watch unbending compromise is unacceptable these days of economic crisis of this nation and especially of those that reside in the prohibition zone. Since going to the moon, many new technologies have evolved for the good of all, and especially in the processing of waste and purifying drinking water. They didn't have a long straw to bring up fresh water. Let's come together and find common ground for an affordable, green, sustainable project. There's nothing wrong with 21st century wastewater alternatives. They are affordable, green, and sustainable. Pablo is going around saying that the air vac collection system flaw is it won't go up at 20% grade. Well, how does the gravity system go up a hill? Nothing is insurmountable. My fellow neighbors' compromise is in order here in Los Osos, and another failure will only cost more hardship and money to us and our neighbors. Good government, common sense is needed here by you supervisors for the good of the community. You have heard of the working poor? Well, another problem that the county now has is the middle-class poor. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. DeFatta. Mr. Greening, followed by Rodney Newby.
Thank you. Good morning. I am Eric Greening, and I want to speak about the duration of speaker time, because a week ago there were a couple of times when essentially there was huge public interest and the decision was made, everyone gets 2 minutes. And I think for the time saved, there is a huge loss both in public relations and in the information available to you from those who come most prepared with detailed comments. And I recognize that people get tired of hearing folks from Los Osos. This is an issue I brought up when you took this project on. I predicted, and I have been proven correct, that once you took on the wastewater project in Los Osos, the 94% of us in this county who do not live in Los Osos would get considerably less than 94% of your time and your attention. That was a consequence of the decision you made. I don't blame people from Los Osos who come with 3 minutes worth of prepared testimony, whether they get to give it or not. You may have saved 25 minutes last week, although it could have been a wash if you'd gone to the 1 minute, 2 minute, 3 minute drill where people who simply wanted to indicate what side they were on could have 1 minute, people who could do it in 2 minutes could have 2 minutes, people who had prepared 3 minute statements could give those 3 minute statements. No one was stopped from giving what they had prepared. That is obviously the best way to handle this type of situation. But what gets lost when a sudden decision is made on the issues of the most public interest and concern, and it won't always be Los Osos when the decision is made. Everybody cuts their time. Is that the grumblings you sometimes hear out there, oh, they don't care what we think. It doesn't matter what we say. They're not listening. You hear those grumblings. There is nothing more powerful to fan those grumblings into a major roar that sounds like the community consensus than saying everybody's time has to get cut so we can get through this. You knew, those of you who were there then, when you volunteered to take on a huge project, that it was going to take enormous amounts of your time. And there will be times when the rest of the county needs you, and there may be gobs of us from the rest of the county on something countywide or in one of our areas that will draw similar attention. And I'm hoping that those of us who come prepared with 3 minutes worth will be able to be heard at that time, just as the people of Los Osos need to be heard now. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Greening. Mr. Newby, and I hope you have a microphone. You can pull up just next to the one on the edge there. I think
got
we'll
him set up. Yeah.
Got him set up. All right.
Okay.
Followed by me now? Yes,
yeah.
Indeed. And Richard Margetson is next.
Okay.
Sir.
Good morning, board. My name is Rod Newby, and I'm a disabled vet. And I knew not to go back to Sonny Acres, Duvall's deal. I know he's got a lot of issues with the county. Anyway, I went there, and he put me in a motorhome that leaked. No electricity, and I have lymphedema in my legs, and I told him I needed to get electricity so I could use my compression pumps, and he failed. He kept promising me. I lived like that for 2 months and 4 days without no electricity. I know it's a state law to have electricity and water, and the bathrooms there are condemned. I can't go in there. I was going to Cuesta College taking 2 computer classes and an accounting class. Then my legs swelled up so bad I couldn't walk. So that took a lot of self-esteem, a drop in school for me, because that was what I lived for, because I'm disabled now. And so my self-esteem went down, so I ended up at least at the shelter for right now. Till I can find something better. I got a fixed income. But the way he treated me and kept promising me, and I'd get home from school, yes, I'll have electricity. And it never did happen. And finally, I just said, I can't take it no more. I mean, my legs are swelling up. I had to go to Central Coast Lymphedema Therapy, get them wrapped again. It's just a mess. I mean, or he treated, and he kept promising me, so I thought, well, Friday, then Tuesday, and Friday, Tuesday, and you know, the lymphedema woman, the Dr. Leslin, she goes, Rod, you're going to end up right back in here if you don't get electricity to run those pumps. So, I don't know. I heard I can get my rent back. This is, you got to have electricity and water is what I've heard. But I just want the board to know I did call Marie Cowan up here, the code enforcement. She knows about the stucco building and the people living there illegal, using the bathroom and the trailers and the motorhomes. And I was there when they shut down the stucco building and all of them, when Art Trinidad put, you know, the police were there anyway. They boarded, condemned, breaking the law, and but it wasn't a month later. They just have the straps off, and they're using it. Dan's changed the lock on the stucco building, so he's using it for storage. And, he just wants to do it Dan Duvall's way, and heck with what the code enforcement, or I think the board says. So that's all I got to say. Anything you can do to help me.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Newby. Actually, Supervisor Meacham has a question, I believe.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Not a question, well, more of a question, sir. Have you met with our Department of Veteran Affairs over here in San Luis?
Department of Veteran Affairs, I told I was supposed to go there. I think advocates.
That gentleman there that handles that is a valuable resource. And if there's anything at all that can be done...
That was one of my next stops here.
I would encourage you to stop and visit with him. He's an incredible man that will try to every way he can to help you out.
Do you know his name, sir?
You know, I do not. But
Mr. Chairman, Mike Pipenberg is the Michael Pipenberg is the Vet Services Officer. His office is at the Veterans Hall.
Yeah, vet. Okay.
Yeah, and if you go down there, Mike's got a couple of staff people, and their job is to help people like you, sir. So
thank you very much, Warden.
Be great if you can.
Thank you very much, sir.
Okay.
Could you get him? We have Supervisor Hill's legislative assistant will help make sure you got the contact information there. Mr. Margetson, followed by Lindy Owen.
Richard Margetson, I gave you a handout this morning from the February and then November technical memo on flow and loads. I've talked and brought to this board numerous errors in these reports over the last 2 years. Here's another example, and I'm doing this because when this comes before you, we're only going to get 3 minutes to testify. So since there's so many problems, I'm going to start testifying early. If you look at page one, at the bottom, chart table two, in the last column, the average water usage, gallons per capita per day, is 67. When the report was updated on the next page, they added in the consumption numbers for 2008. And the water usage per capita per day rose to 68. What's wrong with that, both those charts, is the average for the first 3 years for that four-month period is 70.7 million gallons. The total for 2008 is 69.8. So my question, I guess, would be, how does consumption go down and the average go up? These minor flaws lead to bigger conclusions down the road in these reports and in the final EIR. They've been brought to you repeatedly. At some point, and I know Mr. Sajjan brought this up more than a year ago, when of the $4 million that's been spent on these reports, the fine screening report, the rough screening report, and the EIR, is somebody going to sit down with these charts with a calculator? A simple $10 calculator and figure out some of these. I'm just stunned that somebody preparing the final that was released in November didn't look back to see what they had produced in February to see if they were consistent. And with my last 40 seconds on a totally different subject, we're all working towards the homeless situation in this county. I just want to bring up two pieces of information that have arisen in the last day. There's a report out of Washington now that states that 1 in 5 children this year will be considered homeless. The other bit of information is, and you may have seen this on the news yesterday, the tent city in Sacramento that's accommodating the homeless has a population of 2,000. They're estimating that that will grow 40 to 50 individuals per week over the next year. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Margetson. Ms. Owen.
Good morning, everyone. Lindy Owen from the Prohibition Zone in Los Osos. I, again, just want to remind you that I don't come in here because I like to go around bothering people and making trouble. I am very concerned and have been for 7 years now about what kind of a project we get, what kind of money we spend, what kind of energy we use, and how green we can make it. And if it were possible, I would even enjoy being able to see us make an award-winning plan. What we have coming along the railroad train right now is a complete wreck, just like the last wreck. And I don't know how to ask any of you to look deeper into what we aren't getting. I want to know why the people of Los Osos don't know what options they have. I want to know why we don't know how much energy any particular plant, how much energy will the step design with a pond and ag exchange take? There is no answer. It's lost in pages, in 3,000 pages of a $2 million EIR. I mean, there is something seriously wrong, and that's why I come, and I will continue coming, because I can't sleep at night over this. It's still, something has to change here, and I hope that it gets caught in one of the other agencies because our county staff that's working on this project is not capable of doing it. They can't even see their way out of the forest, I think, now. I want to know why we don't know what the cost might be on a step system with a pond and with ag reuse. We don't know what it costs. I mean, we have estimates. We knew before the project even started that they were going to give us a $250 a month charge. I mean, they were going to spend $25,000, and there's no end to that. It can go higher and as high as it needs to go, and it will. So I'm asking you right now to take serious concern with what the Sierra Club, surf riders, and others are saying, is that the gravity conventional sewer is not a good choice for Los Osos, and it's way too expensive. These are not luxury times. We've just heard hardship. When you have hardship, you reorganize your thoughts, you reorganize your plans. And I'm a little bit tired of hearing everybody talk about how much of a hurry this is. The nitrates, the main cause of the highest nitrates are below Cabrillo Estates and at the golf course, none of which is being sewered. Interesting. The rest of the nitrates are actually below the natural level. If you remove the 28 milligrams of nitrates that are from that one little area of Los Osos, our average is under the danger zone. So the hurry is more about getting this funding, which is then pushing us towards old plans that were made obsolete and rejected for very serious reasons, mostly for energy and impact on the environment. So
thank
please
you,
look at other choices that aren't being looked at.
Thank you. That concludes public comment, but I do have a speaker slip from Supervisor Patterson as well.
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chair. Madam Clerk, would you put the overhead on? Thank you. I am the board's representative to the Carrizo Plain National Monument Advisory Committee, and we've been working for the past several years for a resource management plan for the monument. And the draft plan was released on January 23rd of this year. And on the overhead, I have some information that I want to share with the public and my colleagues on the board. The Bureau of Land Management has held three public workshops over the course of the last 3 weeks to introduce this draft plan and the environmental impact statement that analyzes the plan. Our third and final workshop was this past Saturday out at the Carrizo Plains elementary school, and I just want to let the public know that the plan is available and public comment is due by April 23rd. I have CDs of the plan in my office, and I can be reached at actually my legislative assistant Amy Gilman can be reached at 781-4339. If you'd like a copy of the management plan on CD to comment. There's also a website where the plan can be accessed over the Internet, or hard copies can be obtained by contacting Judith Sackett of the BLM. Her phone number is area code 661-391-6088. Again, that's Judith Sackett of the Bureau of Land Management in Bakersfield. Her number is area code 661-391-6088. And that's my report back.
Report back. Thank you. Thank you, Supervisor. Supervisor Hill had a brief announcement as well.
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chair. I have an office hour this week. On Thursday at 4 o'clock to 5 o'clock at the Grover Beach City Hall, the conference room next to the city, the council chambers is where I'll be. And again, that's this Thursday in Grover Beach City Hall from 4 to 5. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Mr. Hill. And I'll just wrap up public comment with a brief response. I have great respect for Eric Greening. He comes and gives us absolutely the things we need to hear from his perspective, and I respect that greatly. As to the matter of public comment and the decision to shorten the individual times last Tuesday, it was not about Los Osos. It was about managing the time on the agenda so that all those with issues before this board had a chance to be heard in a reasonable time. We said it many times, this board absolutely does want to hear what the public has to say, and there are many ways in which you can do that. You can send us a letter, you can approach each of the supervisors at their office hours, you can email us information, and you absolutely can come and give oral testimony, whether it be in general public comment or related to any specific item on the agenda, and we do want to hear it. Most times, our agendas are structured in a way that allows for each individual to get 3 minutes. And to the extent that it's reasonable to keep in that structure, we will. But there are times, occasionally, and I hope it's not very often, where the need to balance the access to this board's forum is going to have to be managed a little bit. And there are a couple of different ways to do it. In the case on last Tuesday, I did believe it was reasonable to take each speaker to 2 minutes. And we did that both for the Los Osos item and for the one trailing. And we ended up having a closed session after that. The key concept is fairness. And I would suggest that those who come who absolutely feel they need to have 3 minutes to get all the information out to us might be well to write that information down. Written information can be submitted at the time that the meeting occurs, at the time that you come up to speak, and that information does become part of the formal record of the proceeding. So I will endeavor in every instance that I possibly can to continue our tradition of unlimited public acts, public comment at 3 minutes per speaker on those rare occasions where I believe, as the chair, that it's in the interest of all those who have business before the board that we cut it down slightly. That would be the rule of the day. So I appreciate your understanding of that, and we'll hope that we can move forward to have the robust and vibrant public discussion that's at the basis of what we do here. With that, Madam Chair, would you introduce our presentation item, please?
The presentation item is the submittal of a resolution proclaiming 2009 as American Red Cross Month.
Thank you, and I would entertain a motion on that. We have Supervisor Shajian and Supervisor Meacham, I guess. As it is a resolution, we'll take a roll call.
Mr. Shajian.
Aye.
Mr. Meacham.
Aye.
Mr. Hill.
Yes.
Mr. Patterson.
Aye.
Mr. Gibson.
Yes. And I've asked Supervisor Patterson to do the honors today.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and I'd like to invite Mr. Brian Duvall up to receive the resolution. Mr. Duvall is a member of the Red Cross Board of Directors. It gives me great pleasure to read this resolution proclaiming March 2009 as American Red Cross Month in San Luis Obispo County. Whereas, celebrating its 92nd year in San Luis Obispo County, the American Red Cross San Luis Obispo County chapter has led the effort to prevent, prepare for, and respond to disasters, making our community a stronger, safer, and healthier place. And whereas the San Luis Obispo County chapter and its volunteers and donors provide valuable tools and education to individuals, families, workplaces, and schools, making us all stronger and more resilient. It is a place where compassionate people freely give their time and talent to help prevent and ease human suffering among friends, neighbors, and even strangers. And whereas we celebrate the contributions of the American Red Cross in San Luis Obispo County and across the nation, we must also look forward and do our part to ensure that the Red Cross remains vital, ready to help prevent, prepare for, and respond to the unknown challenges that lie ahead. Now, therefore, be it resolved that the Board of Supervisors does hereby proclaim March 2009 as American Red Cross Month and urges all county residents to continue to give their time and money to make a difference in the humanitarian fabric of this community. The San Luis Obispo County chapter receives no financial support from the National Red Cross or the federal government and relies upon local contributions to support local activities. When we help the American Red Cross, we help each other. It gives me great pleasure to present this resolution.
Welcome to make a few comments. I do have one speaker's submitted a slip. We might hear from him first. You're welcome to stay at the lectern. Mr. Alsop.
Thank you. Thank you, and good morning, Ron Alsop, County Office of Emergency Services. I just wanted to add and point out what a very valuable contribution the San Luis Obispo County Chapter of the American Red Cross makes to the overall disaster readiness and response in our county. Everything from working on shelter agreements. As you know, when there's a large disaster, we turn to the Red Cross to open up the evacuation centers, if you will, the care centers that will take care of evacuees. And on an ongoing basis, one of the things they did, the American Red Cross does locally on a day-to-day basis, is maintain agreements ahead of time with the various facilities that would provide those shelters. They actually staff and help us in the County Emergency Operations Center. They actually fill a position in there so they can quickly open shelters if need be. They come out to the incident command post in the field to coordinate with emergency responders. They help us in drills such as we're having later in the calendar year, a federally evaluated evacuation drill up at Camp Roberts where they take care of the evacuees. And I especially want to comment on their volunteers, their disaster action team members. I had the pleasure a couple of weeks ago of speaking to the countywide meeting of their volunteers. And not only was I surprised and impressed at the turnout, but at the enthusiasm that group has about helping people in their various roles. And these aren't folks that just show up and then they roll out and start helping people. They have to go through training courses. There's a structured environment. So there's a lot involved with being a volunteer with the American Red Cross. And they have some great folks over there. In fact, we have one of our folks, one of our professional emergency services coordinators that formerly worked for the San Luis Obispo County Chapter of the Red Cross. And we appreciate them priming her for us. She's doing a good job with this, and that's in no small part to the skills she learned with the Red Cross. We certainly appreciate them cooperatively and working not only in our disaster role, but getting a lot of members and local community groups prepared to deal with disasters. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Alsop. Mr. Ball?
Mr. Chairman, members of the board, contrary to what you may have heard from Supervisor Asajian, I have not been on the board for 92 years. So, thank you so much for the resolution. It helps us with our public awareness. I just want to expand on some comments that Supervisor Patterson made. And there is a public misunderstanding that we do receive funds from National Red Cross or from the government. We do not. We are 100% responsible for funding our own budget. And disaster relief is one of the main items that we deal with. It could be a disaster of a single-family fire, floods, earthquakes. We never know. It always comes as a surprise. And we have to be there. And as Ron said, we have a ton of volunteers who are trained to go out and take care of those problems. So again, thank you so much for your resolution.
Thank you, sir. Mr. Meacham?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And I just wanted to thank you, Brian, and also Ron. I had the pleasure to work with both of these gentlemen in 2003 when we had a little shake up in Paso Robles area and all through the county. But I guess now is probably the most appropriate time to remind folks to not become complacent. These things will happen again. And I can't stress enough the good opportunity that you have to contact the Red Cross's website. It can give you all of the information you need to prepare yourselves in case of a disaster. It's not a question of if it'll ever happen again. It's a matter of when. And so the better off you are being prepared, the better off the entire county will be. And these folks are a tremendous asset to all of us. And from my standpoint, I greatly thank you. I know the board does as well.
And I'll tag on my appreciation for the volunteers that work for this organization. My older son had occasion in the fall of 05 to spend a couple months with the Red Cross during Katrina and Rita doing computer networks in a place of the world that he didn't really know before he got down there. And I think beyond the good work that promoted, he found a group of folks who are remarkable in every way, folks from all over the country, responding out of the best inclinations of the human spirit. And he tells some great stories and has, I think, permanently seen the volunteers and the people of this country in a different light. And I appreciate the Red Cross doing that and urge everyone to participate. There's a wide range of things that this wonderful organization does. Supervisor Shajian?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And my experience goes back quite a few years when we had the flooding in Nipomo and Oceano. And Red Cross was there and appreciated time of need when you folks come in, no questions asked. You're there to help the citizens. Brian, I know you haven't been there for 92 years, but you've been there forever, and I thank you for your tireless efforts. And you are the trademark as far as the Red Cross goes. Thank you.
Thank you. Ladies and gentlemen, at this point, we're going to take a short break. We need to do a technical reset on some of our software on our web feed. So I'll go ahead and call the morning break, and let's convene at 10 minutes after 10 o'clock.
Microphones are live.
Thank you, Madam Clerk. We will reconvene the morning session and ask you to go ahead and introduce our next item, please.
Your next item is C1, a hearing to consider an appeal by Ruth Sullivan of the Planning Commission determination that a zoning clearance for a residential vacation rental cannot be issued for the property located at 3234 Studio Drive, Cayucas, 2nd District. This item was continued from January 27, 2009. Recommend denial of the appeal.
Thank you. Mr. Jansen?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Matt Jansen, planning staff. I have no opening comments other than to introduce John Bissell, who is quickly becoming our vacation rental ordinance expert. So, John, take it away.
Mr. Chair, members of the board, John Bissell, county planning staff. I wanted to give you some background on this project. The initially started out as a code enforcement case for operating a vacation rental without a license. They came in to get a zoning clearance application. We determined that because there's one next door, we couldn't issue one because of the 200-foot limitation in the ordinance on vacation rentals. And my letter to the applicant is on page C1-49 of your staff report, explaining the process of going through a minor use permit to ask for a waiver of that. Instead, the applicant or the appellant appealed to the Planning Commission. The appeal was based on the location section. Also, she appealed the validity of the ordinance, referencing Coastal Act Section 30222 and also the section on vacation rental tenancy. Location-wise, this is the way we measure location, basically, when we look at 200 feet within the same block. There's an example of how the measurement is done. The appellant's property is on the bluff in Cayucas. There's a vacation rental immediately next door. Her property is showing up there in yellow. The vacation rental next door right here is showing in red, and that's an active vacation rental. So it was too close, obviously, to issue a zoning clearance in compliance with the ordinance. The appellant brought forward that to your board, also incorporated the appeal to the Planning Commission, talking about the validity of the ordinance. Our position on that is that the ordinance was adopted by your board, it was certified by the Coastal Commission, and is therefore a valid ordinance and enforceable by us and your board. She also referenced the Coastal Act Section 30222, which talks about use of private lands suitable for visitor-serving commercial recreational facilities designed to enhance public opportunities should have a priority over private residential, general industrial, or general commercial development. But this section really is focused on commercial areas that are visitor serving, not residential. And this is a residential area of Cayucas. And so we felt this section really didn't apply to her property. They also discussed the vacation rental tenancy, saying there was a discrepancy in the ordinance and in the framework for planning. Both framework for planning and the ordinance specify a 7-day period where you only can have one tenancy. The only difference is in framework for planning, there is an allowance for a one-time rental of 14 days or less per year, and that would not fall under the definition of a vacation rental. So an individual could rent their house out once per year for 14 days or less and not be a vacation rental, but anything else would be considered a vacation rental if you're less than 30 days. So with that, staff is recommending that you consider the appeal by Ruth Sullivan and deny it based on the findings in Exhibit A of the staff report. And that would conclude my presentation.
Thank you, Mr. Bissell. Any questions of staff at this point? Mr. Hill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Bissell, in regards to the, I guess, the possible remedy of applying for a minor use permit, do we know how many have applied for in for this specific purpose and what the results are?
My understanding, there was a couple early on after the ordinance was adopted in 2003. I wasn't involved with them. There was the, they may have withdrawn or they weren't successful. I don't know the history, but there hasn't been an approval of a minor use permit for the waiver yet.
Okay. Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. Mr. Meacham?
Yeah, just quickly, John, also in that same regard, the cost to get a minor use permit, about $2,700, something like that, is that?
Well, it's actually approximately $3,255.
And can you explain to me why that's so much?
Well, that's actually our lower price, the minor use permit in the coastal zone, because of the fee structure and the way we, the fees that were adopted by your board, basically that's the lowest fee we can charge for something like this.
Maybe Mr. Jansen could explain the basis, time and motion studies and things like that in terms of how we structure our fees.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair. We did a pretty extensive analysis of time and motion related to all permits just a couple of years ago, and it resulted in our fees going up a considerable amount, but they still are not at full cost recovery. I think the fact of the matter is that for discretionary permits, especially in the coastal zone, there are no easy projects. And it takes quite a bit of time to do full analysis of the local coastal program, which is several documents that need to be analyzed in addition to the standard general plan policies. And the fee structure is what it is based on the time we spend on projects.
Mr. Shajit.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I know this was brought up last time we discussed the vacation rental. And if we put somebody through minor use permit, are we spot zoning since we have an ordinance in place? And my other question probably is more legal. How can we say yes to one and no to the other? And that's, I know, based on our ordinance in place. But can we have some clarification of
regarding an application for a minor use permit and the findings? Well, they looked at it on a case-by-case basis, really, and to see if there is, you know, a reasonable argument to provide the waiver. I mean, it's with vacation rental ordinance, it is a difficult situation with that 200-foot limit. There is a provision for asking for a waiver, but we haven't had any experience yet in actually making findings that would allow a waiver of that. We'd have to look at each case and see what the specifics were and see if there would be a reasonable argument for recommending approval of that. So, if that answers your question or not. But.
It's okay. It's not to where I want to. It won't clarify for me because we have an ordinance in place and the findings is based on that ordinance, but not necessarily if it's going to be considered a spot zoning or not.
Spot zoning?
If we allow somebody to go through the process for minor use permit and to pay $3,500+, and if that's considered spot zoning, what would we allow them to go through the process knowing that you have an ordinance in place doesn't allow that, but then the legalities kicked in, and I don't know if council has anything to offer.
Jim Orton from County Council's office. We'd have to look at the individual situation. The purpose of the exception is to provide an opportunity if something were to arise that would allow for an exception to be granted. And so I don't think it's a spot zoning because it's part of our rules that the Coastal Commission has blessed as part of the local coastal program and that the board has adopted. But we'd have to look at each one as John said, on a case-by-case basis. I think there would have to be an application for a minor use permit and an analysis done in order to make that determination.
Mr. Chair, if I could add on to that, there are three cases that I'm aware of of minor use permits being processed after the ordinance was adopted to try to get the 200-foot limitation, density limitation waived. And each of them had to, there was quite a bit of density already occurring in those areas. So I would agree with council that it's case by case. For example, if there was only one other vacation rental within 200 feet in this case, your board might be able to make those findings. But if there are five others within 200 feet, then maybe that's too many in a small area. So each of those cases that came before the previous board, it was difficult to approve because they were already in a such dense situation with vacation rentals. This one happens to have one next door.
Well, and I think the issue is we're going to basically a ministerial process with this ordinance where we issue a zoning clearance. If it meets certain performance standards, it gets its clearance. And one of the significant, I think you have to drop back to the intent of the ordinance, which is we understand vacation rentals are a commercial use proposed for a residential neighborhood, and the performance standards in there, including the 200-foot residence, were there to strike that balance between what's a reasonable amount of this sort of use. And it's been determined that one generally in a 200-foot radius. But there are bigger issues than that, especially since we have units grandfathered in. I think we can look at this as well community-wide. How does this affect the neighborhood as a whole? The actual ordinance isn't real specific as to the findings necessary to grant the minor use permit, if recollection serves. But it is there as an allowance against the exceptional case that our performance standards can't detail in every situation. So with that, let me explain, because this is an appeal. We will offer the appellant, applicant, same party, 10 minutes to present their side of the appeal. I have two speaker slips from Ms. Sullivan and Ms. Sullivan. You're welcome to take that 10 minutes between you. You'd be welcome, one of you, to take that 10 minutes, and the other could speak for three in public comment. And we then go to I have a number of other speaker slips from the public who would like to speak. When those are done, the appellant will have 5 minutes for any closing remarks, and we'll then bring it back to the board. So with that, I would assume that one or both of the Ms. Sullivans would be starting us off here. And how do you want? Do you want to split the 10-minute time? Okay, that'd be great.
Good morning. A goal of the Coastal Act is to provide low-cost visitor-serving opportunities for others to enjoy our coastal resources. We should be furthering county tourism and the Coastal Act goals to promote coastal tourism by making available to families more low-cost, visitor-serving housing and access to the beach. When I brought this up during the appeal to the Planning Commission, Commissioner Sarah Christie indicated that the Coastal Commission recognizes camping as meeting coastal low-income vacation housing criteria. Let them camp is like that, let them eat cake. Families are provided more family-oriented and available housing when they can rent a home on the beach. It's cheaper than two or more rooms in a hotel. Although the Coastal Commission apparently came up with a 200-foot density in the last hour when this ordinance was subjected to their review, the Coastal Commission staff has said it is up to the county to change the ordinance and they have no objections to the county modifying the ordinance. John Bassell indicated at the Planning Commission hearing that he verified the commission staff was okay with county modifications to the ordinance. The Coastal Act would be furthered by expanding, not limiting, vacation rentals. It's up to your board to make the change. Now, I know that the voters who elected you are the ones who have your ear, but in the case of Studio Drive, tax roll records reflect there are only 10 owner-occupied homes out of 61. Those 10 owners and their elected representatives should not be dictating to 84% of their neighbors what they can do with their homes and who, when, and how long they can use their home. I submit to 10 voting homeowners so I submit to protect 10 voting homeowners so they have the Studio Drive beach as their own private beach is wrong. I have offered the house to charities to auction off, but apparently that is barred by the ordinance, or is it? The Planning Commission indicated that it might be okay. I have a family stay at my home. I had a family stay at my home on an open-ended basis, as a cancer-ridden tenant's dying wish was to die with her family at the beach. Fortunately, she lived 30 days, so the ordinance wasn't violated, and she got her dying wish. There was some indication last week that if the home is not used for full 7 days, it must be vacant the rest of the 7-day period. Why? What is gained by that? I have lived on York Mountain for 47 years. I have 5 daughters, 8 grandchildren, 5 step-grandchildren, and a great-grandchild, and my brother and brother-in-law and sister-in-laws, and between all of my blood relatives, we have a large amount of people involved, so don't continue to call the county if you see my family at my property. And they will all be Brysons or Sullivans. And I'm sharing my time. Well, I wanted to say, at the Planning Commission, somebody brought up that the motorcycles were also, there were some motorcycles there. I'd like you to know it was the police chief of Visalia, his lieutenant, and the sheriff. I'm sharing my time with my daughter, Shauna Sullivan.
Thank you.
Good morning. As you know from last week, my mother owns that beachfront house in Cayucas that sits vacant as she cannot rent her home. I forgot to give you my name, Shauna Sullivan. Rent her home until the county's ordinance, under the county's ordinance, prohibiting any use of private homes as vacation rentals if one is located within 200 feet. Although rental of more than 31 days is permitted, fair rental value just would not cover even the property taxes, let alone the service the debt on this property. I concur with Eric's comments that he made earlier that 2 minutes, or limiting us to 2 minutes, is not proper, especially when we prepare for 3 minutes. You probably wouldn't even be hearing from me today if I'd gotten my 3 minutes last week. So I'm going to take that opportunity now to say the things I couldn't say last week to encourage your board to modify the vacation ordinance to eliminate that 200-foot density limitation. I'd also like to incorporate by reference in this appeal all of the submissions and comments that were made at that hearing on March 3rd in this appeal, as I think there were very important comments that were made, and I hope that this board listened to those comments. If you want to put tighter controls on the issue of creating workable solutions to address noise, access to property managers, and parking, to apply to all vacation homes, that's fine. That makes perfect sense to do that. However, your own enforcement officer said that he only had 5 or 6 complaints. It looks like an awful lot has been generated out of 5 or 6 complaints, some of which were the same home. It doesn't make sense to prohibit vacation homes because there's some problem with some vacation homes. It's like saying if you have driving violations, you should prohibit cars. Well, that's just not going to happen. Why prohibit the vacation homes and impinge upon private property rights of those owners? And the majority of the people that spoke at that hearing, I heard, they were very conciliatory towards the people who had issues on noise and parking. But it appeared the majority of the people there were saying don't limit or reduce the vacation homes to solve those real or perceived problems. Yet what I heard our local supervisor state was that he wanted to have the ordinance reinterpreted or amended to further limit vacation homes or to authorize easier revocation of permits. Please do not limit visitor serving opportunities and the bed tax and tourism revenues that come with it. Don't let a few local NIMBYs prevent others from enjoying this coastal paradise. A study by the Cayucas realtors, some data they collected, shows that throughout Cayucas, 32% of the homes are owner-occupied, 24% are full-time rentals, and the rest, which is over 43%, are vacant homes. Do you really want to preserve the character of a community that has so few occupied homes? And what about the revenues that would be generated if those homes paid bed taxes and promoted tourism? I don't know why we'd want to have a retention of a character of a neighborhood that doesn't have anyone there. doesn't make sense. Now, as to this particular appeal, my mother received a letter last June demanding she obtain a business license and to apply for a vacation rental permit. And that's in your packet at C-173. She immediately attempted to comply and was given the letter attached to your packet at C-175. She couldn't apply for a business license or permit because the house next door already had one. The determination we're appealing stated, you can't ask for a waiver of the 200-foot limitation by, I'm sorry, I'll say that word. You can ask for a waiver of the 200-foot limitation by MUP for $2,787. Now it's over $32,000, as was stated earlier, $3,200. But since the ordinance went into effect in 2004, there's not been any successful waiver. Since the fee is non-refundable, there is a significant risk you will not receive the approval and will lose the MUP fee. We are appealing the county's refusal to give the required applications. We'd be willing to risk the $3,200 if there was any hope in getting a MUP. But all indications, even in response to the board's questions today, is that it's not going to happen. And if the board's position is that there is a possibility that we wouldn't be completely wasting the $3,200, we would do it. But I'm not hearing that, and staff is certainly not saying that there's any possibility. And as one of your supervisors mentioned, it doesn't appear that a case-by-case process is going to change that. Because if you have an ordinance that says it's 200 feet, I don't know how you get around that. So the ordinance needs to be changed. And as reflected by my mother, the ordinance was the 200-foot density requirement was put in at the last minute by the Coastal Commission, is my understanding. It wasn't what this county promoted at the time. And what the county or Coastal Commission staff has indicated is that they're willing to consider a change in the ordinance, but it has to be initiated by this county. So I think it's time to initiate the change and get rid of the density requirement they put in so long ago, because it certainly doesn't help our county to limit vacation homes. And it certainly doesn't help the Coastal Act's purposes of promoting this resource and making it available on a statewide basis. To prohibit economic use solely based on an arbitrary 200-foot straight line or even radius has been recently proposed for reinterpretation makes no sense. The home next to this home is vacant. I've never seen anyone there. On the other side is a vacation home. It's never been a problem. They're good neighbors. And it makes sense to have two vacation homes in close proximity on beachfront property to create this radius that's been suggested or to further limit in such a small neighborhood at Studio Drive. It just doesn't work. So the ordinance should not apply where that 200-foot density just doesn't work. Please don't try to reinterpret the ordinance and expand the prohibition. And we request that you get rid of this 200-foot unfair, unconstitutional, arbitrary, and capricious, counterproductive density requirement. We should be making our resources available to people, not right.
Thank
taking
you.
Away.
And you'll have a chance to have closing
sure,
comments. I have
you.
Supervisor Shajan and then Supervisor Patterson. Did you have your light on for this?
Previously.
Okay. Supervisor Patterson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Ms. Sullivan, were you or your mother aware when the property was purchased of the vacation rental ordinance? Was that brought to your attention, or was that your intent when you purchased it?
We were aware of it, yes. It was, but the statute doesn't make any sense. And it's
well, that,
very poorly
that answers
written,
my question.
And,
thank you.
Okay.
Thank you. Any other questions? Supervisor Meacham.
I do. Ms. Sullivan, you mentioned of the folks that live there, 84% of these do not, they're not permanent residents. Or,
right.
How many other vacation rentals are in the entire area?
I don't know that off the top of my head. I know one of the other speakers is going to speak on public comment can show you an overview of it. I tried to show it last week, and there was some kind of glitch or something, and you couldn't see it. But there is an overhead that's coming with another speaker.
So the one that's next door to your residence, that's not the only vacation rental in this particular area.
I don't believe it is.
Okay. Mr. Bissell, do you know off the top of your head in Cayucas how many vacation rentals we have? 250, I think, is about.
How about for just Studio Drive?
Well, I'm looking for Studio Drive mainly because of the reference to the 84%.
I don't know the total number on Studio Drive. There's another one that's about, I think, another three parcels down Studio Drive from the Sullivan parcel. There's one more active one that I know about, but I don't know the number in that area specifically.
So I would assume that if a person were to apply for a minor use permit, these numbers were going to be should be presented so that they take this on a case-by-case basis, as Mr. Kenny's mentioned.
That's correct. We would have all the numbers for the commission and board or whatever.
Thank you, sir.
Thank you. I don't see any other requests. Supervisor Meacham, that's your question. We have a number of requests to speak. I don't know if Mr. Bissell, during that time, if you have access to the internet there, you might be able to pull up the map for Cayucas. We could get a line on that. First request to speak is David Dugan, followed by Lance Carney.
I believe he's going to rent a DVD, and I'll Dave Dugan, and I'll talk while it's going on. I made a point to go down to Studio Drive. It's separate from Cayucas, I guess you would call it proper. This is Cayucas Minor. It's a stretch of its own. And I believe in this case, a cookie-cutter ordinance doesn't work. Majority of those homes are empty. And I believe that Rue Sullivan is paying over $25,000 a year in property taxes. And I don't see how she's getting any benefit out of doing that. I've been down on Studio Drive, and I made it for this hearing to go down there on different occasions, different times of day, on different days, to see what goes on there. It's a virtual ghost town. And so what you have there is a private beach in a private area. And when it is being used, it's being mostly used by people who don't live in town, who are not renting a vacation rental, or Tascadero, maybe some other out of town close by. They come all the time. So if you have a parking problem, it might be because people who live in the area are using up all the parking spaces, so you can't really blame that on the vacation rentals. I want you to consider granting this appeal. Financially, everybody's in dire straits. The county needs the money. They could use the taxes off of this. The one point, the 200 feet, I don't see that the overhead is not working. It's a DVD, not a CD.
Yeah.
And it will show, I have video of it showing. On one occasion, I made sure that I'd go there when there would probably be people there. And it is a ghost town. I have video of that. I also have an overhead shot, and this was a Google overhead. And it shows the beach free of people on a nice sunny day. And more than one occasion, other than on the 4th of July or Memorial Day, that beach is virtually unused. And that goes to public resource. If was any chance of a waiver being granted with conditions, I would hope that they would do so. I know you're amending the ordinance, and I would propose that you, if you're going to amend it, that you will allow vacation rentals within 200 feet of each other, and perhaps put a some kind of condition on it. And because it's a ghost town, it's a private beach now, and 10 residences are getting the advantage, and all those other homes are empty. And I'm sure that the economic standpoint, as well as the fact that I believe this is truly unfair to somebody who has paid so high a property tax, $25,000 plus. Thank you,
Mr. Dugan. Mr. Carney, followed by Sylvia Loretti Goldhammer.
Good morning. My name is Lance Carney, and I live at 79 Gracia Avenue, which is off Studio Drive, with my wife and two small children. And we're 12 houses from Mrs. Sullivan's house. And Cayucas is not a ghost town. The bus stops along Studio Drive and drops off my children, as well as the kids that I know of that are on Studio Drive and the Studio Drive area, which I consist of the finger streets that are off of Studio Drive. We're all in the same neighborhood.
and there's about eight or ten kids that get dropped off along Studio Drive. It, in our opinion, it's a family neighborhood. The kids play, our kids play with other kids in the neighborhood. The entire community, including Morro Bay, Cayucas, and Atascadero, and whoever, walk down, up and down the beach. There's quite a bit of use at the beach, and it truly is a gathering place for the community. There's many access points, and they all get plenty of use. And yes, there's cars at all of the access points that are there. There's certainly more than 10 full-time residents. And the houses in her neighborhood only consist of the beachfront houses. She's only consisting the beachfront, and I don't know where the 61 number comes in, because from the south end of Studio Drive to the north end of Studio Drive, just beachfront, there is more than double that amount of houses. If you include the whole neighborhood and the finger streets, I forget what the number was, but I counted it for the last meeting that was before the Planning Commission, and there's over 200 houses in our community. And I do believe that there is a lot of empty houses, but it certainly is not a ghost town, and I think her statistics are far off. And we're a working-class family, and we paid a high price for our house so we can raise our children in a safe environment. I pay a lot of taxes to have services that I feel that I'm not getting. We don't have the resources to police when it's on the weekend, on a normal weekend, let alone the 4th of July. 4th of July is ridiculous, and what happens in the summertime down there is ridiculous. Our safety is compromised by the number of rentals and their behavior, the drunkenness, fireworks, fires, noise, parking, driving. We need enforcement of the existing codes, not a variance which would allow more vacation rentals. Allowing more vacation rentals in an already highly condensed area of vacation rentals will cause more problems on an already taxed sheriff department. We are entitled to the quiet enjoyment of our home and a safe place to raise our children. Thank you for keeping in mind this when you're determining this issue.
Thank you, Mr. Carney. Ms. Loretti Goldhammer, followed by Catherine Rossi.
Good morning. My name is Sylvia Loretti Goldhammer, and I live on 3250 Studio Drive in Cayucas. 8 years ago, I moved from a beautiful black forest in Germany to this wonderful area of the central coast of California. I love this country, the beautiful nature here on the central coast, and the friendly people I have met during the past years. I'm here today to comment on the request of Mrs. Sullivan that would grant her an exception to also be able to get a license for vacation rental just like the house next door to her. Well, first of all, if she gets a permit granted, everyone else who asks for an exception should have a right to get it, which would then be the end of the current ordinance. Moreover, Mrs. Sullivan bought the house in 2006, and that was 2 years after the ordinance had already been in effect. As Mrs. Sullivan stated in the public hearing on March 3, 2009, she needs some money to pay for the extremely high property taxes. However, it was clear when she bought the house how much tax she would have to pay. Besides that, she could rent the house out as a permanent rental. She could then easily pay the taxes and still make a profit. In a letter by the daughter of Mrs. Sullivan, people on Studio Drive were accused as being the super rich who want the beach all to themselves and not have any vacation rentals. This is a false accusation, and besides that, there are not many homeowners who could be nearly described as super rich. The only ones, if any, who can be described as super rich are the people who can afford to buy these expensive homes nowadays. And without the current ordinance that could actually endanger the whole residential neighborhood, that these so-called super rich buy the houses and do not even think of using them for themselves, but turn them into vacation rentals. In a commercially zoned area, there would, of course, not be anything wrong with that idea. However, a residentially zoned area should not be turned into a commercial area. Also, let's not forget about people who own a beach home now or plan to own one in the future and are also paying property taxes and who do not want to live next to a hotel if they decided to live in a residential neighborhood. And I also cannot understand how people can describe to pay $2,000 or more for 1 week and say this is an opportunity for low-income families. There are vacation rentals that actually do charge less than $1,000 per week, but they are not beachfront then. And concerning the ordinance, I mean, it was done for a reason, and the only thing I could see is that if somebody applies to also get a vacation license that they get in a kind of line, and that people who have a license, they can only get it for 1 or 2 years. And if somebody else is requesting one, then they should get a turn, something like this. But, and I mean, to describe a Studio Drive as a ghost town is absolutely incorrect. I mean, I can walk through San Luis Obispo, through some neighborhoods, and not see people in the street. I mean, people are just not sitting in front of a house all the time or having the music on. They also spend time inside the house. I thank you for your time.
Thank you so much. Catherine Rossi, followed by Dave Goldhammer.
Yes, good morning. I want to sincerely thank the board for what you listened to last week with the vacation rental license ordinances, that you carefully listened to an awful lot of people, many more people than are here today, that said, look, things are working, but please, no more density, no more density. And the issue that you brought up in introducing this, Mr. Gibson, is that you said, yes, you know, that really these are residential neighborhoods and yet an exception is being made for commercial purposes with vacation rentals. This means that the vast majority of people that are in each of these neighborhoods are paying property taxes, you know, say at least 10 out of 100 are maybe getting the vacation rental licenses. But the fact of the matter is that the vast majority of people want to live in single-family residential neighborhoods. By allowing greater density of vacation rentals, what you're saying is that the person that has the vacation rental license can have a commercial business. And currently on the books, what that means is if they sell their property, their vacation rental license goes with the property. It's a commercial business. I fundamentally disagree that any vacation rental license should be transferred when the property is sold. When you live in a neighborhood that is residential, you buy into it because it's residential. You buy into it before there was any such thing as vacation rental licenses. There's an expectation that your time and effort and money and care and love is going to be you living in a residential neighborhood. And there are problems with vacation rentals. It could happen at any given house at any given time. Because in Cambria and Cayucas, there are the rules and regulations. What's happened over the last 5 years is the problems have gone from this to this. The vacation rental license ordinances are, in fact, working. I'm sure you may recognize me as one that would like to see these ordinances extended to the unincorporated areas of Los Osos. But certainly in the meantime, let's not expand. Let's respect the fact that these are residential neighborhoods. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Ms. Rossi. Mr. Goldhammer.
Yes, my name is Dave Goldhammer. I live two houses south of Mrs. Solomon's property. And excuse me if I'm repetitive here. I did not get to listen to the entire discussion. I would like to address in my time some specific statements that were made in the documents by Mrs. Sullivan's attorney, her daughter. One of those was that there was no probable cause for Mrs. Sullivan's property to be investigated by the people who were enforcing this ordinance from the county. And to that I would say, by the fact that Mrs. Sullivan knew that this ordinance was in existence and chose to rent her property anyway for almost the entire summer, indicates that there was certainly probable cause. Secondly, Mrs. Sullivan's attorney, her daughter, claimed in the documents that it had been Mrs. Sullivan's dream to own a beach house. And I would say that that flies in the face of the fact that this house has been mostly used as a vacation rental and only minorly used by Mrs. Sullivan or her family. Third, Mrs. Sullivan says that, or her daughter says that she needs to use this as a rental to pay for the property taxes. Certainly Mrs. Sullivan knew when she bought the house for in excess of $2 million that these property taxes were going to be high. I would readily embrace Mrs. Sullivan moving into our neighborhood, living in her house, enjoying the ocean, having it be her dream house, but the reality is that she's chosen to not use her dream house. She now has it on the market. Point out that she has it on the market for close to $3 million, which is significantly higher than what she paid for it, and she bought it at the top of the housing market. Question whether she's really serious about selling this property. My fear is that Mrs. Sullivan will continue to use this property as a vacation rental, as she did last summer, even though she knew that this ordinance was in effect. She had complained about it to my wife. And I certainly hope that this board does not sanction Mrs. Sullivan using this property as a vacation rental by granting this waiver. It would open the door for many, many of the houses in this, in our neighborhood, which will be coming on the market because they're owned by elderly people. Granting Mrs. Sullivan this waiver would, in essence, nullify the ordinance, and I think that is not something that is consistent with an attractive residential neighborhood for the Cayucas area. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Goldhammer. That concludes the public part of public comment. With that, we can offer the appellant 5 minutes for closing remarks, if you desire them.
I'm wondering if Mr. Bissell was able to get the video on yet, or maybe even show the vacation homes that were in that area.
Mr. Chair?
Sure.
While John is working on the technological challenges, and I'm hoping, we haven't started her time yet, the phone call I received was from our Assistant Director, Cammie Griffin. Cammie did a little bit of research, and we came up with, for the full length of Studio Drive, and I'm not so sure that's the perfect way to look at it, because as Mr. Kearney described accurately, I think you should be looking at these as smaller neighborhood issues. But for the full length of Studio Drive, we have 27 vacation rentals out of 108 parcels for the full length. So that's approximately one quarter of the full length comprised of vacation. 27 out of 108 parcels.
Thank you. Mr. Bissell?
I do have the map from the last meeting we had last week on it that I could show, that shows kind of the distribution along Studio Drive. This is the Studio Drive area right along here.
Full screen that?
Yeah, let's see if I can full screen that. Okay. This area, this is Studio Drive, and this is the bluff top area. You can see there's quite a few vacation rentals throughout the length of Studio Drive, and there it continues down and down to the south all the way. So it has quite a few along it already. I don't know the exact
that count. Southerly portion is the location of this particular parcel. Okay. Any questions from colleagues on that map? Seeing none, Ms. Sullivan?
I'm just wondering if the video is going to be able to go on. We've tried it 3 times now at different hearings and unsuccessfully.
I think it's ready.
Okay, there we go. I wanted to say that this home has been primarily used by family. As my mother indicated, we have a very large family. It's unfortunate the neighbors are watching us always, counting heads, always checking up on us, making presumptions. But it is used primarily for the family, and it is for sale because my mom can't service that debt and pay the taxes without having some income coming in from this. Obviously, if it's rented full-time, then she can't use it, which is not the goal of having this. I mean, she wants to be able to use it. If it's rented full-time, then she can't use it. And I don't think we could find a tenant that could afford to pay the price it would take to at least just service the debt and the taxes. So, even though I realize it's unlikely that you will grant this appeal, at least we've been able to say what we wanted to say last week. And I hope that we've given you some food for thought of setting up some kind of procedure for allowing for waivers, because the beachfront property such as this, and you can't look at Studio Drive as a whole because it's divided into different sections. To say that that we're going to be limited to so few homes being allowed with this 200-foot linear footage or expanded to radial, as some people were proposing it be expanded to, is counterproductive to the goals of the Coastal Act. And you really can see it's pretty dead. Now, the house that the Goldheimers live in is the one with a really big boat in front blocking the front of the house. You'll see it right there coming through. I'm not sure that that's valid to have such a big boat in the residential area like that. But I'd also like to point out that it's really hard to have a single-family home in a commercial area. I mean, you put single-family homes in single-family residential areas. And to have a home that people can rent, a single-family home, you're not going to find it in the commercial area. You're going to find it in the single-family residential areas. And when there's very few people around and the houses are empty, then the county's not generating any revenue or bed tax in these homes. And it also forces a lot of these homes to go underground with the vacation running, which is what's happening with some people. So I appreciate your reconsideration of this ordinance, and if there's any hope that we can get a MUP approved, we'll go that route. But I'm not hearing that there's any hope to get around this 200-foot, so I request that you change the 200-foot. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Sullivan. With that, we'll close public comment, bring it back to the board. Any colleagues have questions? Supervisor Hill?
I'll wait. If you're going questions, I got some comments, but I can wait
okay.
Until questions are clarified.
I don't have any other lights on, so I'll follow whoever's last here.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Chair. I don't see how we could make the findings that would basically violate the ordinance and set a bad precedent, but I did want to respond to some of the things that Ms. Shauna Sullivan said. Certainly vacation homes aren't prohibited. They're simply regulated, and as Mr. Jensen pointed out, there's 27 alone on the Studio Drive itself, so clearly there are quite a few just on this stretch alone. I don't think that the private property rights come into play, certainly because people don't have, you know, an absolute right to use their residences for commercial purposes. And as I think was pointed out when Supervisor Patterson asked, Mrs. Sullivan bought the house with the ordinance in place and that was understood. So I just, you know, to my mind, nothing here is persuasive to want to grant this appeal, and I certainly would want us to do something that would sort of undermine the ordinance and set a bad precedent. So that's basically what I wanted to say.
Thank you, Supervisor Meacham.
Thank you, Mr. Gibson. I'm just kind of wondering if it's premature to even make a determination on this with what's coming back to us. We've asked for this ordinance to be revised and come back, and in my opinion, this I can sympathize somewhat, but I also feel that my fundamental concern is for the residents that live in the areas. We have heard time and again from a lot of these folks that what is needed is further regulations or restrictions to protect their way of life. That's primary for me. I think that if we can find ways to do that, and I think that along with the applicant's opportunity to seek out a minor use permit, that doesn't preclude that from happening. And even though it may not look like it's promising, as was told by staff, it's taken on a case-by-case basis. It tells me a lot more that we have 27 out of 108 parcels that already have vacation rentals that are probably going to be having a difficult time getting through that. But and the comment made about it's a ghost town, well, I can tell you that there was a number of folks that came here at the last hearing that wished that their area was more of a ghost town and not so many of the vacation rentals taking place. I know and I understand completely the need for vacation rentals. I think that we should have that in this ordinance, and that's why the board has asked for this to come back with a tightening of regulations. No one has said don't do vacation rentals. They've just said please regulate them better. And so from my standpoint, I just cannot find the compelling reason to support this appeal at this point in time based upon where we're going, what I've heard, and what we expect to see when it comes back.
Thank you, Supervisor Patterson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I concur completely with Supervisor Meacham. I think it's our responsibility to preserve residential neighborhoods. The issue of property rights works both ways, and we do have a process for waivers in place, and we did give this ordinance a thorough vetting at our last meeting, and it will be coming back to us. And I think that the fundamental flaw, basically, has been the lack of enforcement. And if we can improve that in some way, many of the problems associated with the vacation rental ordinance will go away. But I do fundamentally think that our primary responsibility is to protect the residential character of the neighborhoods while allowing for vacation rentals in prime vacation locations like oceanfront properties, Cambria, Cayucas, coastal properties in general. We still do need to protect the residential character of the neighborhoods. And so I cannot at this time support the appeal.
Thank you, Supervisor Patterson. On my own behalf, I think colleagues have spoken eloquently to the rationale for regulating this, and I'll make a motion to deny this appeal in just a minute. I would only add to them that in Cayucas, as I recall, there's somewhere north of 250 vacation rentals, and if memory serves, there are about 1,700 or a little bit more total residential single-family dwelling units. So we're talking about one in seven homes, more or less, already being a vacation rental. And it, colleagues have spoken to the implications and consequences of that. I'd only add one thing, which comes from Ms. Sullivan's testimony, where she had recently done a survey or gotten a hold of some data, suggests that 43% of the dwelling units in Cayucas are not principal residences. Well, last I had that data, it was more like 35%. We'd known for quite a while that about 35% of the homes in Cayucas were not principal residences. Seeing it go to 43% is some statistical information on a trend that we can feel in town, and speaks to the fact that as homes become non-primary residences, if they're used for vacation rentals or not, it starts to affect neighborhood character simply by the fact that there aren't families like Mr. Carney's, for instance, able to find a long-term rental. That has resulted in a significant drop in the population of the school, over 40% or 50% in the last, how many years has it been? 10 years, let's say, since my children were students at Cayucas Elementary and Middle School. So I think there are valid policy issues on both sides. We had a thorough discussion of that last week and more today. And with that, I will move staff's recommendation to deny this appeal and uphold the finding of the Planning Commission.
Second.
Seeing no further discussion on the motion, Madam Clerk, a roll call, please.
Mr. Gibson.
Yes.
Mr. Hill.
Yes.
Mr. Meacham.
Yes.
Mr. Asajian.
Aye.
Mr. Patterson.
Aye.
Thank you. And Madam Clerk, then, if you would please introduce our next item.
Certainly. Your next item is C2, a hearing to consider, one, a resolution adjusting the in-lieu and housing impact fee schedules in Title 29 Affordable Housing Fund, and two, a request to authorize processing of amendments to Title 29 Affordable Housing Fund and the Inclusionary Housing Ordinance of Titles 22 and 23 to clarify the affordable housing requirement on new development. All districts recommend approval and instruct chairperson to sign.
Thank you. Mr. Stevenson?
Thank you, Chairman Gibson, members of the board, Chuck Stevenson, planning staff. We're here today to discuss a couple of items with you. One is to have you consider some possible adjustments to the in-lieu housing impact fee in Title 29, and also some changes that we feel will strengthen and clarify the inclusionary housing ordinance that your board adopted in December 2008. Ted Bench and Dana Lilly are here today to make the formal presentation, so I'll turn it over to them at this time. Thank you.
Thank you. And I'm Ted Bench with County Planning, and good morning to the board. I prepared a PowerPoint, which I'll try to run through quickly. The background here is that the county adopted the Inclusionary Housing Ordinance and Title 29 not that long ago, December 9, 2008. And in today's hearing, what the board is being asked to consider is to increase the fees required by the Inclusionary Housing Ordinance and also to consider authorizing the staff to prepare a cleanup package for the ordinance. Now, the fees in the Inclusionary Housing Ordinance, which are also found in Title 29, Title 29 establishes the fees. The fees are actually a developer's option. The developer can choose to either provide affordable housing as required by the ordinance, or he can pay fees. Now, the fees would be used by the county to pay or to build the affordable housing in those cases where the developer doesn't do so. Title 29 requires that there be an annual fee adjustment, and in a typical year, that adjustment will be reflecting the construction cost increased over the prior year, and that's something you find in the construction cost index. But when the board adopted this in December, they also adopted a five-year phase-in plan. So as we are looking at a fee increase and whether or not to increase the fee for 2009, the board has some choices here. We can either stick strictly with the five-year phase-in plan, or we could include the cost of the construction cost in with the five-year phase-in plan, or you could even decide not to raise the fees this year and wait until next year. So to go over those options a little more clearly, option one would be to make no fee adjustments this year. And there's some reasons you might think of doing that. One is to look at today's economy. It's in a downward spiral at the moment, so this may not be the right time to be increasing inclusionary housing fees. If the fees were deferred for another year, then gives the housing market time to adjust to the new inclusionary housing ordinance and adjust to the fees. Also, it would provide, if there was no fee increase this year, if the fees increase was deferred to next year, that makes this feel more like a 5.5-year phase-in period rather than a 4.5-year phase-in period. What I mean by that is when the ordinance was adopted in December with a 5-year phase-in period, it did not make the requirement go away that you have to consider fee increases that would go into effect every July of each year. So the fee increase that is coming up actually very quick, if you were to adopt a fee increase right now, having said that you just adopted the ordinance in December, it feels more like there's only been a half a year from when the ordinance was adopted to when the fee was increased. So that's why it feels more like a 4.5-year phase-in period is in place rather than a 5.5-year phase-in period. Again, there's other options. You could go to, you could increase the fees this year. You could go to phase or year two of that 5-year phase-in period. And as you could also consider adding a fee for greenhouses, commercial greenhouse development. That was a direction that the board gave staff in December when the ordinance was adopted, that when the fees are increased, to be sure to bring in a fee for greenhouse construction. So what's on the screen right now is what the fees would be if you were to increase the fees this year to go to year two of the phase of the 5-year phase-in schedule. As you can see, a sample project on the bottom of the screen would be, say, a single-family residence. The in-lieu fee for that residence right now at year one is almost $4,000. In year two, it would go to approximately $8,000, so that ultimately in 5 years, when the ordinance is fully in place, the fee will be about $20,000 per house. And again, the developer can pay the fee or he can construct the affordable housing unit. The next slide here shows the addition of the commercial greenhouse fee to the housing impact fee schedule. Now, the ordinance or the resolution that's attached to your staff report includes reflects this option too. The ordinance in your staff report would authorize the increase of the fees to go to year two of the five-year phase-in period. And so exhibits A and B in that resolution show the fee amount for year two, and it also shows the greenhouse fee being added. And as I mentioned earlier, there is a third option, which would be, again, to increase the fee to go to year two of the five-year schedule, but also to add this year's construction cost increase. The construction cost index shows that there's been an increase in construction cost of 5.4%. Again, the purpose of these fees is if the developer would rather the county, rather to pay the fees so that the county builds the affordable housing instead, the fees are adjusted each year to reflect the change in construction cost. And so that's why we have a third option, which is to, if you want to increase the fees, go to year two of the fee schedule or the phasing schedule, and also include the construction cost increase. So what's on the screen now is a chart that would show what that cost increase would be, again, for a single-family residence and also for a small commercial building. Now, staff suggests of the three options that the board consider option one or two. Option one being not to raise the fees this year, defer any increase to next year, or option two, which is to go to year two of the five-year schedule. Now, staff is, as you've already seen, there is a resolution in your package that would go to year two of the phase-in schedule. What I'm about to hand out is a resolution that would actually not increase the fee schedule at all, would defer the fee schedule increase to next year, 2010. What this resolution does is it allows the program to continue as it is, which is that fees would be required for new development, and we would use the fee schedule that's in place right now, which is the year one fees in the five-year fee schedule. This, again, is a resolution that the board can consider when you take action today. There's time reserved in the future if you on the hearing of April 7th, if your board feels like you would like to, if your board feels you need to give staff more direction, staff can come back on April 7th with a different proposal for whether or not to increase the fees this year. I want to summarize the fee increase discussion by simply saying at this time your board only needs to consider whether or not to increase the fees for 2009. The ordinance requires that in a full year, after a full year has gone by, that you once again look at the fee schedules, but you also will be giving a annual report and an action plan that will describe the fees that have been collected by pursuant to the Inclusionary Housing Ordinance and makes recommendations as to how the fees can be paid or be spent, what type of project the fees could be used for. And this will happen in December of this year. So in December, you will get the action plan and the annual report that's required by the ordinances, but you will also get opportunity once again to discuss fee increases, but those would be fee increases for the year 2010. That's the first part of this discussion. The second part of this discussion deals with...
I have a couple lights on, and I wonder if Supervisors Patterson and Meacham have questions on the first part that they might want to ask now, or do you want to wait till the end of the discussion?
I'd actually like to ask a question now because it's
sure.
relative to the fees,
sure.
Mr. Chair, if I may.
Sure.
Okay. Thank you. Mr. Bench, the fees are addressed on an annual basis, as you stated, requirement of Title 29, and we will address them again in December of 2009. When do they actually take effect?
Every year they will take effect on July 1st.
Okay. So what we're considering now will not actually, if we were to suggest a modification of the fees today, they would not take effect until July 1st of this year.
That's correct.
Okay. And then again, the commercial greenhouse fee would be included. That was something that wasn't in the original ordinance that we adopted, but I do remember having discussion on that, and it was recommended at the time that we add that at the next revision, which is this opportunity.
That's correct.
Okay. Very good. Thank you. Well, actually, one more quick question relative to that. You talk about the construction cost index, which is basically an inflator based on the increase in cost or decrease, I presume, if that were to be the case, that we consider annually as well. And the resolution that you passed out does not include that factor in it. That's the one where we start over. Would it be adjusted in the overall five-year plan in the future? Would we include that when we readjust the numbers for the five-year phase-in?
Yes. The way the ordinance is written is that every year when there's a fee increase, it generally would be based on the construction cost index for that year. So, actually, next year you will have to deal with this again. Do you want to look at increasing the fees? And if so, do you want to base it only on the whatever year of the phase-in plan you're in? Or do you want to base it solely on construction cost increase, or both?
Okay. Thank you.
Since we're on that subject, if I might, Supervisor Meacham, jump in. Is that construction cost index published monthly?
It is published. It's a nationally recognized news service, engineering news service.
So, and is there a particular reason why we would be studying the fee question in December for an application in July? Could we do it closer to July?
The way the ordinance is set up is that the fee adjustments were to be considered, all these fee adjustments were to be considered at the same time that the county considers its fee adjustments for all construction permits.
Okay. Thanks. Mr. Meacham?
And on that same vein, why do we use the San Francisco cost index?
There are other jurisdictions that use the same tool, and they're located fairly close to us geographically, and that's the index that they chose.
I would think that theirs are pretty high. And I guess in on the example of these phasing fees, if we get out to year five, the single-family residence, about almost $20,000 for those. At the rate that we are seeing the declining property values, that may be 20% of a house. I guess the second phase of this is, are we going to be talking about C26? Is that where we're going in the next part of your discussion?
Yes, we're going to talk about it.
Then I'll wait until we get there, and then I'll ask the questions I have in that regard.
Seeing no other questions, thank you. Mr. Bench, you want to continue with your staff report?
Thank you. The second part of the discussion is deals with a request to your board to allow staff to prepare a ordinance cleanup package or ordinance amendment package. And the reason we're presenting this to you today is there's been, now that the ordinance has been in place for a couple of months, there's been time for both staff and the public to look at it, and there's been comments that have come up that show about ways that we could either clarify or strengthen parts of the ordinance. And I'll go through a list fairly quickly of what some of those changes might be. And again, if your board does give staff direction to prepare an ordinance amendment package, we would take that package through the Planning Commission for their consideration and then back to your board for final action. So some of the changes would be, for starters, to clarify that the bonus units that are allowed by the inclusionary ordinance are, in fact, supported by the other documents in the general plan. And we can use the example set by the Transfer Development Credit Program. Bonus units are allowed by the TDC program as well, and there's all parts of the ordinance reflect that. So we can do the same thing for the inclusionary bonus units. We could also consider another thing we could consider is allowing when a subdivision is going to have inclusionary new lots in it that are inclusionary lots required to meet the inclusionary housing ordinance, that the lot sizes of all the lots in the subdivision can be adjusted to make those affordable lots fit in. The other option, of course, is just to allow only the affordable lots to have a smaller size and so that they can fit in. What this package would do, again, is it would allow both the public and the staff the opportunity to consider changes like this and then make recommendations to the Planning Commission and then to the board, so that while I may suggest some of these changes on this list, this is not a recommendation. This is not a request for final action by any means. This is a chance to open up a discussion on these topics. So some other changes that might be considered are exempting commercial subdivisions from the inclusionary ordinance. And again, that's commercial subdivisions that are only creating vacant lots, because when buildings come in, commercial buildings come in, then we'll know what type of commercial building is being proposed, and we could apply the ordinance at that time. You could consider exempting all condominium conversions that are not creating any new development, but keeping in mind keeping the protections that the existing condo conversion ordinance has right now, which is that some units shall be set aside as affordable units. So we would suggest building on the existing ordinance we have now before making, when we consider any changes to the inclusionary ordinance. You could consider exempting mobile home parks from the inclusionary housing ordinance, new mobile home parks, that is. And again, when it comes to when the paying of the fees, the ordinance requires that the fee schedule to be used is the one that's in place at the time that the ordinance or that the fee is being issued or that the subdivision map is being recorded. So you could consider maybe allowing the subdivider to pay sooner using an earlier fee schedule if he decides, in fact, that fees are the way he wants to meet the ordinance requirements is by paying fees, and he has conditional approval of his conditional use permit approval or his tentative subdivision map approval, maybe he should be allowed to go ahead and pay fees earlier than later. So to summarize the recommended actions, what the staff has presented to the board is a package, and the actions your board can consider is to adopt a resolution that would adjust the fee schedules, as I described in option two, to adjust the fee schedules to go to year two of the 5-year phasing plan, or you could adopt a resolution that would not adjust the fee schedule, or you could continue this discussion on fee increases to April 7th and provide further direction to staff. Now, the second part of this package in front of you today is a request to authorize staff to prepare an amendment package to do amendments to the inclusionary housing ordinance. And that concludes staff presentation.
All right, thank you, Mr. Bench. Mr. Meacham?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Question on the C26 section F-.3E, credit for alternative methods. I'm a little uncomfortable with this verbiage. The planning director, at his or her sole discretion, shall determine the monetary value of the proposed alternative methods. On what will they base this?
Just give me a second. This comes out of a section of the ordinance that deals with options that a commercial developer can use, and there's many options that a commercial developer can use. He can either pay a fee or build employee housing on site, or even do an employee housing program, such as a first-time homebuyer program or a rental assistance program. All of these are good options as long as they have a monetary value that's equal to what he would have, what the fee requirement would be.
And are those fees already established?
That's correct. That's what this ordinance has in it.
Because the way this reads, it's almost as well, whatever somebody thinks would be a fair thing to do, that's what they do, and that's what discretion tells me, but I don't think that would be appropriate. The next question I have for you is dropping down to point number 11 about the Napomo Community Services District has challenged the inclusionary housing. Can I ask what the history behind this is and why that is?
The portion of the Napomo Service District service area is a declared water shortage area, phase, or LOS 3, LOS 3, level of service 3. And Napomo Service District has expressed their concern about allowing almost any new development in that water shortage area, particularly a project that might have bonus units, such as what's allowed by the Inclusionary Housing Ordinance or the TDC program. So staff will continue to meet with the NCSD and see if we can come to a resolution.
So inclusionary housing is relative to resource capability in this particular case?
That's what the challenge is based on, is the, if I understand it, the question, the...
Okay, and I guess I'm trying to determine if that works in all areas in terms of resource capability.
That's correct. The ordinance as it's set up right now has a special finding on any new development in an LOS 3 area that the decision maker has to find that there's substantial evidence that there's enough water available to serve that project. However, the NCSD would like to explore that particular issue further.
And does, if you don't mind, and if that in fact is the case, then if you, let's say for example that you have an inclusionary number that's required in this development project, does that ratio down proportionately if you have a resource restraint? I mean, by the number of units versus the number of inclusionary units?
I think another way to say it is that the inclusionary requirement stays there, but if the water shortage is such that having bonus units is really not an option, then the applicant would have to choose other options to meet the requirements, such as paying fees.
Actually, let me try to step in here. Dana Lilly, also with your planning staff. There was two related issues to that. One is trying to provide some certainty to the applicant of how many units are allowable on a given piece of property, even before a bonus is considered. So we have language in the ordinance that tried to make that more certain. But we recognize there may be special site circumstances where you can't reach that base density. And yes, the overall inclusionary requirement would be applied towards what actually can be put on the ground. The second issue, so it would ratchet down.
Okay.
The second issue was a bonus. So if the developer wishes to provide the affordable units on site in the project, the ordinance would provide a one-for-one bonus in the total project size. And the Pomo Community Services District was concerned that that might increase build-out for their community in areas where there's a question about the water suitability. So there was a special finding put in the ordinance, and that's what Ted was referring to, that we're still in discussion with the district about, is that finding and the wording that was in the IR appropriate?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you. Mr. Shajan?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And that's exactly why we met, unfortunately, Mr. McNulty's not here with us to give us his point of view, but we did meet with folks from the Pomo Community Service District, because I have similar feelings as the Community Service District. When it comes to density bonus provisions, we do have a problem. We cannot, on one hand, say that you have a level severity 3 as far as the water, then put an ordinance in place that forces them to consider bonus density, but what's in front of us here today is strictly the funding mechanism, correct? The fee schedule. And they probably in areas of Nipomo, then it will be encouraged for any contractor to or developer to consider paying the in lieu fees rather than the density bonus. And that's the 11, number 11 on C26. Is there to address that issue, and I just want to be on record to say that we have requested to stay with both councils, still communicating till such time that we have an agreement. We'll bring it back to the board, otherwise it is considered a pending litigation as we speak.
That's a correct statement.
Thank you. With no other lights, I just had one quick one. Going back to Supervisor Meacham's first question about the planning director's determination of value, I was in conference briefly with Mr. Edge and may have missed it, but I would assume that the planning director's determination of monetary value is subject to the appeal of any other planning director's determination, which would eventually come to this board if it gets to that. All right. With that, I have, seeing no further questions, I have a few requests to speak. Dr. C. Height, followed by Jerry Bunin.
Dr. C. Height, Los Osos. Okay, well, I guess my big question is, will the county build it, though? If the developers don't build it, will the county build the affordable housing? And I think that it's really essential that the developers don't believe that they can pay you off and not have to include ADA-compliant units, which would be inclusionary housing. It would be affordable housing to your veterans. And I realized that last week an ADA issue question came up. I believe it related to rental units, and I believe the question could easily be answered. I think that each one of you here could be aware of what you're voting on and what the consequences are if you'd have sent your counsel downstairs to look at the ADA. It's at the law library. So, you know, my concern is that it looks like you're passing the buck, because you know you have an affordable housing crisis. You have a public housing crisis. You don't recognize that when people come forward and say, well, we're kind of in trouble with HUD because we have, you know, no 10-year homeless plan, I think that you don't realize that the buck stops here, that this was a county failure. So, when you talk about paying somebody can pay a fee to not build affordable housing, in these times it just doesn't make sense. And you need to be leaders in this. You know, Paso Robles has been a leader in this. You need to be aware of whether it's a rental unit or whether it's a family unit, whether it's a tourist unit. You need to be aware of what the law is and stand behind the law so that everyone is included. Thank you.
Thank you, Dr. Height. Mr. Bunin, followed by Bruce Buell.
Sturb Union, Government Affairs Director, Home Builders Association. We urge you to choose option one on the regarding of the in-lieu fee. We were here 3 months ago and we agreed to a 5-year phase-in, and now we're back today discussing a 4.5-year phase-in for bureaucratic reasons. We brought to you the idea of going to a longer phase-in because home building economics are really nosediving and they've only gotten worse since then. So we urge you to keep it at 5 years or go to 5.5 years. I've also given all of you a copy of a brief on the City of Patterson versus California Building Industry Association on the in-lieu fee. I don't expect you to read it today. I also made copies available for your staff, and I made your staff aware of the case before today so they can discuss it with you. Based on the staff report, considering this to be an AB 1600 fee, we do believe that the Patterson case applies. What I would ask you to focus on is the issue of reasonableness on the in-lieu fee. The bottom line is reasonableness is certainly going to be subjective, but I would suspect that we would all agree that it's going to be something that involves being fair and equitable, and the in-lieu fee is not. If the in-lieu fee is determined by the cost of measuring the sales price of a median-priced home versus the cost of building an affordable unit, you're putting all of the burden on the new construction, and yet we're only 1/6 of the homes that are being sold. For every new home we build, 5 additional homes are resold. So we think that that's unfair, but rather than argue that, we'd at least like to not have that fee moved up on us. The other thing I would like to focus on is the changes that the staff is looking at. There's a couple I want to support and a couple I'm really concerned about. We support the concept of going to a smaller lot size for all the units, and also I believe that's on number 8 in the staff report, reducing the percentage of inclusionary units if you build them off-site. Both of those are going to actually help the economics of building the units. If you don't allow those, the chances of building the units anywhere, the affordable units, are going to be much lower. We're very concerned about item 5.2C regarding the number of bedrooms. That, to me, looks like a very arbitrary decision that the county would be making. It's the same kind of question that I think Supervisor Meacham raised regarding the determination of value. So those are things that I know that if you agree to go ahead with them, we'll go get to talk to staff about them, but they also seem very adding to the level of unpredictability that goes into the planning process that's already making it problematic. I'm running out of time. I'd like somebody to ask me a question about Napomo. Otherwise, thank you very much.
Mr. Chair, it's not about Napomo, though.
He only wanted a question about Napomo.
Is that it?
Yeah,
I'm
done. Thank you.
Yeah. Mr. Hill. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Bunin, I wonder if you could speak in a little bit more detail about how option one would, in fact, benefit the home builders' economics. I mean, seeing as...
Bottom line is it doesn't make any sense to build right now.
Right.
I mean, the numbers are totally upside down.
Mm-hmm.
And adding $4,000 per unit, per market rate unit, it's not going to make that better. It's going to make that worse. Going to $8,000 is going to be, you know, it's very problematic. We're also facing a whole bunch of other fee increases, whether it's fire sprinkler ordinances and stormwater management ordinances. All of these things are going to make it harder to build. And, you know, we were happy with the 5-year phase-in. A 4.5-year phase-in makes us progressively less happy. 5.5 years would make us progressively happier. It's going to help.
Happy in a year and a half.
Happy as in it's going to give us a better chance to build eventually. It's raising the cost doesn't help. So that's the point of view on that.
So what about Napomo?
You know, thank you very much. What a great question. The reason why we followed this all the way through, the inclusionary ordinance, and we don't like inclusion ordinances, everybody knows that, but what we advocated for was having a variety of options on how to comply. And that gives us the opportunity when we're dealing with a community with Napomo that has water, sewer, and traffic issues to find different ways of dealing with this. So you're not going to go to Napomo and say, give me an extra 20 units and a 100-unit project. You're going to look to build those somewhere else, or you're going to look to pay the in-lieu fee. So it doesn't add to the problems that we're all having with the various issues in Napomo. But trying to get community support for a density bonus unit in Napomo is going to be even more problematic than getting the project built. So that's why you have all those various compliance options. So this is not dealt with.
Right. Supervisor Patterson, you have
yes, I do.
Non-Napomo question.
Not a non-Napomo question. Mr. Bunin, regarding the increase, the annual increase based on the inflationary increase of building, your recommendation is that we basically start the clock over. This ordinance was adopted in December, and so by the time these new fees and the phasing will kick in, it would be July 1st. It runs on a fiscal year rather than a calendar year. So you're asking us to freeze everything, basically, and start the clock over beginning the five-year period, July 1st of 2009. What are your thoughts about that inflationary increase, because that does occur, and I would agree that maybe we don't need to include that this year. But what I've seen so many councils do, and including this board prior to my service on this board, deferring fees annually until a point in time when they've accumulated to become a huge number. Do you think that it makes more sense to increase them incrementally, as has been suggested here, rather than waiting, deferring them for 2, 3, 4 years, and then it becomes a 20% increase or a 25% increase? And you didn't speak to that, but I was wondering what your opinion is relative to keeping current with the cost.
2 points. And I don't believe I advocated starting the clock over. We would be more than happy to live with the five-year phase-in. In other words, if you would agree today that the increase starts in January of...
No, July is when they start.
I understand where it starts. We're here because the county started the clock over, not because we're advocating it. The clock should have started in December and in January and had a five-year phase in every January. We would be more than happy to live with that. What the county is talking about is not doing a full year, doing a six-month phase-in. So we could live with that. I don't know if you could change your ordinance, but if your ordinance simply says that today we're going to have a new fee, 1/1/2010, that's okay. The other part of that is, in terms of the cost of the construction cost index, you know, I don't always agree with some of the people I represent on that, but, you know, basically you should be, when you're raising the fees, you should be factoring the cost of your project in. So if that was going to be an increase that would take effect in increments every year, I would not have an issue with it.
Well, that's the idea. That's why it's on here now.
I'm arguing in terms of a five-year phase-in. If, you know, I'm against a four-and-a-half-year phase-in, and in one of my wildly optimistic moments, I raised the possibility you would go to a five-and-a-half-year phase-in. Does that make sense?
Well, it does, except... We're talking today about July 1st of 2009.
I understand.
And if we go to the 5.5 year, which you're recommending, we would start, well, 5 would start July 1st.
No, 5 would start in January 1 of 10. But let me add one point to this. Is I was speaking with Ted and Dana beforehand, just so I was fully clear on this. I'm going to pay my fees when I pull my building permit. The amount of money you're going to lose by waiting till from July to January is microscopic, because there aren't going to be very many people pulling building permits. So we're not talking about an enormous amount of money, but we are talking about giving us the full year that we already all agreed to when you approved this in December.
And I think we do, let's get on with the public comment here. I think we do need to come up with a rational checklist how we're going to analyze inflation, where we're going to start clocks, and how we're going to phase, and we'll do that when we bring it back to the board.
Thank you,
sir. Mr. Buell, followed by Michael Wynn.
Good morning. I'm Bruce Buell, General Manager, Napomo Community Services District. I'm here this morning to support your staff's recommendation that you authorize an amendment package. As you know, and it has been discussed at your board level, the district does have concerns regarding the existing language. The district would appreciate the opportunity to continue working with your staff We do want to thank Supervisor Sajian for hosting one meeting already. We feel it may take a couple more meetings to get to the point where we have absolute clarity as to what the adopted ordinance means and whether or not we would feel better with potential amendments to that ordinance. Thank you.
Thank you, sir. Mr. Wynn, followed by Jesse Hill.
My name is Mike Wynn. I'm also from the Napomo Community Services District, and I would echo the sentiments of our general manager. We would urge you to continue the item until you have an amendment package. We have no views about your in-lieu fees, and that's the heart of what you're really talking about today. We have no objection to you approving whatever seems prudent to you. But there are some other features in the staff report today that have been alluded to that we have serious reserves about. And as you've seen in the terms of our complaint, it's not only the language of the ordinance, but it's also the EIR on which it is based. So we would like the opportunity to continue the dialogue with your staff, see if we can bring a package back to you that satisfies both of us so this ordinance can go ahead. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Wynn. Mr. Hill.
Thank you, Supervisor. Jesse Hill from Napomo. I'll bring it back to there, and I will be brief this time, which is unusual for me. In Napomo, part of the problem with this ordinance is going to be future development. Right now, you're looking at water and sewer fee hookups of $23,000. That's just what it costs in the urban reserve line because of supplemental water. You know, eventually, if you get to the affordable housing fee at the maximum of $20,000, which I think you should do eventually, you know, you add that, so you're at 43. You got traffic impacts of another 12,000, and then you've got Quimby PFF and school fees of 10, and then you've got another 10,000 in other fees. So right now, in terms of the big picture, what you end up looking at is $75,000 of fees. And when you translate that back to development, since these are all hard money loans, you're adding an additional $600 per month in rental. That's before you even get onto your infrastructure improvements or any other improvements. So I think in the big picture, all those fees have got to be looked at, and it's really going to be tough on any RMF project to go forward with that kind of increase in costs. The smaller lot projects, it's really, really tough with the numbers falling. So I would be in favor of some kind of phasing, and then I think at some point you got to have a big picture look about the ability to build out there. Thank you. I know you're strapped for time.
Thank you, Mr. Hill. So seeing no other requests to speak, I'll close public comment and bring it back to the board. Supervisor Patterson?
Am I still green?
Still down. Okay.
Yeah.
Supervisor Meech?
Carry over.
Okay. First of all, I appreciate Dr. Height's comment about Paso Robles. Paso Robles is the only city in the county that does not have an inclusionary element in their planning process. Things have seemed to work just fine without one. Having said that, I do understand the necessity here and what the board's talking about, and I do respect the fact about reasonable and equitable. Right now, I don't know if any of you read the latest county newspaper that comes out, and I read it yesterday. A number of areas are not only trying to find incentives, but they're reducing fees to try to assist with this economic downturn that we're confronting. And so I think that we need to find a way that we can. I agree with Supervisor Patterson in terms of not going so many years and then all of a sudden throwing a great big fee on top of everything. And I was probably responsible for that AB 1600 study in Paso Robles when we adjusted all of our fees. Fees are a necessity. That's just the way of life. However, to get us there, I don't think that this is saying that we will do away with these fees, but we'll slowly bring these in line over the next few years. And I think that if we were to maintain the status quo currently, in another year we'll have a better snapshot of what this economy is doing to be able to make those determinations. And I don't see this housing turning around anytime soon. Matter of fact, I don't think we've seen the bottom yet. And if that, in fact, is the case, you're not going to see any additional building permits being pulled because no one's going to be doing any of these projects. So any relief that we can find, it's not a gift to anyone. It's more of an incentive to try to assist them with what they're trying to get done.
Thank you, Supervisor Meacham. Any other lights? Let me put my pitch in for some clarity here, because we have different in terms of the fees, and then we can talk about the potential amendment package. We have a number of different issues running on different cycles here. My own thought is this, and see if we have the resolution or whether we need to come back with it. I don't see raising the inclusionary housing fee at this point. I think basically it's academic, given the level of non-building that's going on. And with that, I'd also like to get into a regular and understandable cycle of how we raise, when we raise fees, against what benchmark we do it, and for how long those are going to occur. So my thought conceptually, and I'll leave staff to tell me if we have the documents in front of us to do this, is I would leave fees where they are and start year one of our phase-in as of July 1 of this year. So when we see the tables of inclusionary housing fees and we see the amount in the first year of the program, I'd like that first year to start July 1 of this year. We will come back to a question of what the fee should be. The inflation on the one hand and the phasing on the other are two different issues. So if we start the phasing July 1 of this year, we'll phase it fiscal year by fiscal year. When we come back in December to consider how we are to inflate the fee, I would submit that we take a look at the construction cost index in December of 2009, compare it to the construction cost index of December 2008, which is when we passed the ordinance, and we build that inflation factor into the fee for fiscal year 10-11. So there will be a jump there. There'll be a jump both by the fact that we're moving from 20% to 40%, and also by the fact that before we do that, we're applying the proper inflation. I think if we get onto that system with a clear understanding of what benchmark we compare to determine the inflation factor in December and where we are in the phasing plan, I think we've got a clear system.
If I may.
Sure.
I support that recommendation. It's basically starting the clock over again. We've not used the half year since the ordinance was adopted. We're starting it in July 1 of 2009. I think Supervisor Gibson's recommendation on how to apply the inflator, if you will, is good. The one issue that hasn't been discussed, option two, which was the staff's recommendation originally, also including the commercial greenhouse fee as part of the commercial table application. And I think, you know, and there was a consensus, if I recall the discussion correctly, that we add that it made sense. The ag community was on board with that, and this is simply an amendment to add that to the table, and I would like to do that as well, if we could, as part of the recommendation.
If you wouldn't mind, gentlemen, I'll make this as a motion. The system that I outlined there, and starting on July 1 of this year, that we add the 7 cents per square foot for the greenhouse. And we can go to further discussion on the motion if...
I'll second that.
Okay.
I just wanted to get a little bit of clarity in regard to this greenhouse fee.
It goes on this table here with...
I understand.
That's for commercial.
What's it for?
It's the commercial linkage fee. Maybe Mr. Stevenson could describe commercial linkage fees.
Right. Well, it is a fee associated with the building of commercial buildings that will go toward the Affordable Housing Fund. And there's a distinction that is being made here between the types of greenhouse activity areas. So the fee would apply to, I believe, the internal building area, but not to any outdoor storage area. And I guess the question is more along the lines of, why is this added now and it was not part of it before?
Mm-hmm. I think that was, go ahead, Ted.
Yes, if I understood the question, why was greenhouses not in the fee schedule before?
Mm-hmm.
They were, and it was lumped in with a broad category of commercial structures that didn't fit anywhere else, didn't fit a commercial retail, wasn't a hotel motel, so you couldn't apply those kind of fees. There was a, I can't remember what the fee was, it was something like $2.50 per square foot for anything that fell in that other category. Greenhouses felt that was excessive. So the board directed staff to talk with the Greenhouse Association, and we came up with the fee schedule of 7 cents a square foot based on the fact that you...
I guess, okay, I understand better now that this isn't an additional fee. This is just a reallocation of something that's going to be addressed this specifically then.
That's correct.
Got it. Thank you very much.
And any other questions? I can restate the motion, Madam Clerk, if you desire. My thought would be to have you bring back the necessary resolutions at a later time rather than try to craft them unless they're ready to go right now. And let me ask that of staff. Are we ready to, do we have a resolution that does?
Is that what this resolution
I
is?
I think, is that aside from adding the greenhouse fee into it?
Okay, we just had a brief chat here in front of you, and it looks like we do need to bring this back to make sure that the ordinance before you clearly does what you just described.
Let's do that. Given where we are in the proceedings, I would make a motion to have staff bring back the resolution identifying July 1, 2009 as the start of year one of our phasing plan with the fees in place as they are now. And I don't know if it needs to be part of the resolution, but certainly direction to staff to bring us back the consideration of the inflation adjustment in December of this year based on a December to December comparison of the construction cost index.
We understand.
And the addition of the greenhouse.
And I'm sorry, using the construction cost index. What other index?
Yeah, the construction.
That's it.
Just the construction
Adding the greenhouse gas fee, I mean the greenhouse gas, the greenhouse commercial gas.
Glad you clarified
that. We haven't got that yet.
Exactly. So, with that, no other discussion on the motion. Madam Clerk, a roll call, please.
Mr. Gibson.
Yes.
Mr. Patterson.
Aye.
Mr. Meacham.
Yes.
Mr. Hill.
Yes.
Mr. Asajian.
Aye.
All right. And then I would entertain colleagues' wishes on the matter of directing staff to... We have an authorization request. This is a hearing where we can authorize amendments or package of amendments and entertain colleagues' wishes on that matter.
Mr. Chairman?
Yes, sir.
Staff does have one question about your previous motion.
Yes.
Does that include continuing this hearing to April 7th?
That certainly sounds like a good idea to me.
Thank you.
And the second agrees.
We have time available April 7th. We're already reserved.
Yeah, we're reserved.
Okay, good. All right. Supervisor Patterson.
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chair. Question to staff on page C26 of the bullet points where you actually made amendments, recommended amendments, section F.3. What was the actual change in that one?
To change the word sold to sole.
Well, I see.
Am I in the wrong one? Oh, sorry.
Yeah, no, the one I see that one, but the one above it.
F3.
I don't see any strikeouts or any underlines in that one.
What that particular bullet is talking about is the time at which inclusionary units need to be available in a commercial project. So, say that a commercial developer decides to meet this requirement by building employee or inclusionary units in his commercial project. If it was a residential project, there's a requirement the ordinance has about that the affordable unit has to be ready at the same time the market rate units are. But the include.
Well, was that added? Or
The ordinance already deals with residential development and when the affordable unit needs to be there. But the ordinance doesn't address for commercial projects when the affordable unit needs to be ready. So we would try to use the same concept where suggesting that in a commercial project where there's going to be inclusionary units, that those units be available at the same time the commercial units are available.
Okay, very good. And then if we roll back to page C25, item 5, I think the recommendation, consider exempting condominium conversions that involve no new development or change of use. I think what's important there is that it's not mentioned that there is already the condo conversion ordinance that applies here, and we're not, if we follow this recommendation, we're not exempting them from that ordinance. Is that correct? Does that need to be stated, or
make
that assumption?
Your point is well taken, and this should have been more clearly worded to say that if we talk about exempting condo conversions from the ordinance, that we should not in any way weaken the existing condo conversion ordinance that's on the, that we have in place already. And so
this is just ensuring that we don't apply it twice,
correct.
Basically.
Right.
Okay.
All right. Actually, Supervisor Hill.
I'm sorry.
Supervisor Meacham.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Question, Ted and Dana, on number 7, this is on C25. Should mixed-use projects be exempt entirely? What's the thing? I'm trying to grasp why that would be considered. It says afterwards that presently the projects portion is exempt, but the housing must include some affordable units. I'm wondering why we would consider exempting the mixed-use.
Right now the ordinance actually encourages mixed-use projects because in a mixed-use project, the ordinance applies only to the residential units. The commercial part is exempt from the ordinance. But some developers have suggested that if you want to go the extra step to encourage mixed-use projects, maybe you should make the whole mixed-use project exempt. And that's, again, something that we can consider if we get started on this cleanup package.
Okay. I guess I'm not buying on that one. Because currently any mixed-use project that has housing would apply to, and they're asking that it wouldn't apply, is essentially.
The ordinance applies, but only to the commercial. To the residential units, and the commercial units are exempt.
And to clarify staff's intent, we don't know that the department would necessarily recommend exempting mixed-use entirely, but we've heard it raised as a question, so we just wanted it to be discussed.
And was this, the justification behind it, the idea of encouraging more mixed use by exempting it?
Yes, if we can say that mixed use is a benefit to the county, is it enough of a benefit to warrant exempting it from inclusionary?
Got it. Thank you.
Supervisor Meacham.
Thank you. That was one of the questions, and thanks for clarifying that. The second one, I'm still a little uncomfortable on F.3E about the sole discretion. If there could be something a little bit more, I guess, concrete in terms of what that discretionary ability is included into this, I'd feel a whole lot more comfortable with that.
But it might be, but it might entail more process coming back to either the commission or your board. What that doesn't explain in this staff report is that after a lot of hearings and discussion with home builders, they said, it would be nice if there was an alternative to the options you've presented that allows us to work cooperatively with a nonprofit and comply with the housing that's being required, but in a different way than you envisioned. And so we had this relief valve, you could say, where the planning director could approve that. But we could certainly take your directions to consider tightening that up.
It's not for my intent and my purpose, really. It's for the guys that are going to be sitting with the planning director so that they know what they're being, what they're dealing with. So, thank you.
Mr. Shajian?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Excuse me. I think I'm looking favorably to waive the inclusionary fees for mixed use from the point of view that they do address the they do qualify under smart growth, and they do address the inclusionary housing when you have a mixed use, and that will encourage mixed use to come on.
where you can live in an area and work in an area, no mileage is driven, and does because of those qualifications, I'm looking favorably into considering them to be part of the formula, but and not to pay into any further fees because they're addressing the inclusionary housing issues if they choose to do so.
All right. Any other thoughts there? Looking over the selection of proposed topics for consideration, I think they're all worthy of discussion. This is actually a fairly loose authorization request in that some of these are fairly broadly defined, and a lot more discussion between various stakeholders in this process has got to occur. For instance, on the matter of waiving all inclusionary housing fees on mixed-use projects, I think that's one that's going to require some analysis, considerable amount of analysis, and if we are to propose it, it's going to require certain conditions so that we can see that the policy goals of inclusionary housing are actually going to be met when we do waive those fees. And I just have visions of a couple of mixed-use projects that exist in my district, communities to remain unnamed, that don't do anything really to foster affordable housing and would end up likely as another market rate residence. So that said, I'm supportive of authorizing staff to continue to improve this ordinance through the amendments that it's considered, and would certainly entertain a motion from colleagues if they wanted to go that way. Sure.
Just if I may, Mr. Chair, just for point of clarification, once we authorize this process to begin, it will still go through public hearings and we'll have a fully vetted conversation about it. So with that, I'll move staff's recommendation to authorize processing of the recommended amendments to the inclusionary housing ordinance.
Second. Have a motion and a second. Let's go ahead with a roll call on this one as well.
Mr. Patterson.
Aye.
Mr. Meacham.
Aye.
Mr. Hill.
Yes.
Mr. Asagian.
Aye.
Mr. Gibson.
Yes. Looking forward here, in discussion with Mr. Edge, he suggested, and I agreed, that the presentation by our information technology group on the countywide IT strategic plan can certainly be continued to another agenda. We have a couple of relatively light agendas coming up, so we have, by executive fiat, continued that to another day. County Council informs me that we have an extensive closed session agenda, and there's one other item, so I would suggest we go ahead and carry on with our now last item of the day.
Mm-hmm.
Can take the public testimony of those who have stayed for it, and we'll have Madam Clerk introduce that item to us, please.
Your next item would be D1, consideration of a request to authorize the processing of amendments to Land Use Ordinance Title 22 of the County Code to modify the county's Transfer Development Credits TDC program, all districts. This item was continued from February 24, 2009. Recommend provide direction to staff.
Thank you, ma'am. Ms. Griffin.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the board. Good afternoon. Barely afternoon. I don't have a PowerPoint, and my presentation will be very, very brief to leave you the maximum amount of time to talk and the maximum amount of time for your closed session, since it sounds like it's substantial. So on January 27th, your board provided staff direction to come back with specific authorizations of amendments to the current countywide TDC program. You specifically provided staff direction to limit the creation of new sending sites to only those areas within existing community-based programs, to limit the receiving sites to existing urban and village reserve areas or within existing community-based programs, and to evaluate using the credits for something other than the creation of additional lots. Those were amendments that your board wanted processed fairly immediately. Those were considered phase one of amending the TDC program. You also asked at that time to look at a substantial change in the direction of the TDC program, and that would be considered phase two. And so what we're asking for today is authorization to process the amendments, those simple amendments that are part of phase one, and to also provide staff with direction on the new direction that you would like the TDC program to take. What we're looking for here is really what kind of program does the board want to see. Do you want to see a lot retirement program? Do you want to see a focus on ag land? A focus on environmental land? Kind of what would your focus, what would you want the focus of the program to be? Or all of those, all of the above. And then that will help staff as we go back out and get requests for proposals, find out how much a new program might cost to develop, see what kind of environmental review we think that it might trigger, and come back to your board with some more information at a later date.
So all right.
Two parts.
Thank you. Any questions of Ms. Griffin at this point? Seeing none, I do have a number of requests to speak. We'll start with Mr. Eric Greening, followed by Sue Luft.
Thank you. I am Eric Greening, and I consider that the countywide program as a whole, I think it's time, aside from the existing credits that still can be received somewhere, it's time for that program to go to sleep until such time as the incorporated cities are in dialogue with us. I do, however, believe in supporting the continuation, and our ordinance should reflect the continuation of and the potential creation of community-based programs. In other words, support those that are currently working and allow for the creation of those where the community itself comes together and wishes to create them. However, I do not consider the South Atascadero program to be a community-based program or an example for future ones. Nipomo and Cambria, the benefits as well as the impacts are within that community. They serve an objective that has come out of community dialogue and within the community, whereas the South Atascadero situation is a situation where that area has been taking receiving credits from a completely different and quite remote area. The benefits are not visible or experienced in that community, and the actual polling that led to the creation of that program, 70% of the people did not want to 70% of those who answered the surveys, and it was a very robust answer. 45% of the people responded. Normal with a survey is 10%. Of those, 70% of the people did not want the program at all, and it was simply the second order. If you have to have one, what's your preference? And then the program they have now was that preference. So I would not consider the South Atascadero as an example of a community-based program. I do believe that land banking is a good strategy to examine. It's listed among the various options. However, I don't believe land banking should be considered an implementation of TDCs or necessarily linked to TDCs. It's something that you should be investigating on its own merits. TDCs might be linked to it in a community-based program. I think that's up to the communities. But in terms of the full countywide picture, again, I think any countywide program should be put to sleep until the cities are voluntarily in dialogue with us, and that hasn't happened yet. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Greening. Ms. Luft, followed by Della Barrett.
Hi, my name is Sue Luft. I'd like to thank planning staff for presenting a simple proposal for amending the TDC program based on the board's direction. Phase one of the recommendations appears to be a straightforward approach to ending the sending site portion of the TDC program, except for the community-based programs, and retiring the existing credits. Phase two, revamping of the countywide TDC program, is the most interesting and challenging part. We might try by first giving the program a new name, maybe transfer development rights or retirement of development rights. I think we can all agree that the goals are to retire antiquated subdivisions, reduce urban sprawl and greenhouse gas emissions, and preserve ag land and open space. A land banking program is an appropriate mechanism for meeting these goals. Rather than establishing receiver sites, funds can be generated by requiring contributions in a manner similar to what they've proposed in the phase one portion for retiring credits. The program should start with formation of the land bank through a public process. Mapping should wait until the land bank is formed and criteria for land preservation is established. I ask that your board direct planning staff to proceed with these amendments and work with the Ag Commissioner's Office and the public to develop a land banking program. I ask that planning staff initiate a scoping process to solicit comments from the public and the Water Resources Advisory Committee and other interested parties. A thorough consideration of the broader concepts is needed, and I'm sure many members of the public are willing to help with this process. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Love. Ms. Barrett, followed by Ray Belknap.
Hi, I'm Della Barrett. I live in South Atascadero. And first, on phase one of the recommendation before you, I want to compliment the planning staff. Good job, says I. I like that the whole concept, especially the parts about the credits being used for things other than the creation of lots. Then for phase two of the plan, of the recommendation before you, the problem with the TDC program has always been receiver sites, where to put the growth. And that has been a problem nationwide with transfer development credits programs. So I would like to see you change to what Sue had recommended, more of a retirement of development rights program, and use a public scoping process, maybe a 60-day process, where people would submit their written comments on how to create this transfer of development rights program. And the staff would summarize the recommendations, and but all the comments would be saved so that they could be reviewed. And the areas for scoping would include both how the land bank would work and how it would be funded. But also because any land bank, and particularly in these times, is going to have limited financial resources. One of the other important things would be to collect ideas on how to prioritize which lands or which areas were going to be of a higher priority, a higher focus for preservation. And all of those things, I think, should be taken through a public scoping process. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Ms. Barrett. Mr. Belknap, followed by Jesse Hill.
Hi, my name is Ray Belknap, and I don't have some comments on the specific amendments. I wanted to address the phase two. My concern is that they go away and they become a low priority and it sit on the back shelf someplace. And I think that fire is lit, fire is hot, you got to keep going with this topic until we really can put it to bed. I think that dealing with the TDC bank, or whatever name you give it, is a substantial change to the program. It would be a major change. But at the same time, it has the opportunity to simplify things considerably. With my experience in these in the past, once you have created that, a lot of the ordinance is simplified because the details then move to the arrangement that the county would have with the bank operator about audits, costs, all these sorts of details can be worked out in an agreement rather than in an ordinance. So I'm suggesting we really kind of keep the fire lit for two reasons. One is I think it can be a lot simpler than we think it is. And two, you have an incredibly informed citizenry that really knows these issues well. And I hate to see them dissipate and go away. Lack of interest. My suggestion is we prepare kind of a list of principles, the bullet points, about how this new ordinance of the TDC Bank would work, kind of put that out for some discussion, and if we can reach agreement, then the ordinance amendment can be happen rather quickly because there would be agreement on the basic principles of how it would work. In terms of a focus of the program, that Cammy raised the question, I think I'm going to be the one that continues to remind us that the original purpose was the retirement of legal lots in rural areas. We've got to get rid of those lots out there. Now, to a degree, we can find a lot that has conservation objectives and the conservation element, all the better. But I think the success of the program, as it's measured in the future, is always based on what was its purpose. And I'm going to insist we stay close to that legal lot in that rural area that we've got to get rid of and move towards an urban area where there are services. And to the degree that the program could be a lot retirement, it would be great. For example, if the TDC Bank was able to raise a lot of money, buy a lot of credits, they can trash them. You know, they can raise the money. They don't have to sell them. That's the real advantage of having a TDC Bank. We don't have to worry about the unsold credits. Let them sit there. Who cares? Anyway, keep the fires hot.
Hey, thank you, Mr. Belknap. Stand by, if you would, please. We've got Mr. Shajan with his light on.
Mr. Belknap, thank you for taking time to be here. Having worked with you in the past, I've become a strong supporter of TDC as long as community-based as Mr. Hill and Ms. Griffin work to have a TDC program in the community of Nipomo as good as what's maybe available in Cambria. But since you have mastered this program, can you give us your thoughts? Because when I heard Mr. Greening say, laid to rest countywide, which isn't a bad idea, but on the other hand, in the rural areas, you have quite few sensitive, environmentally sensitive legal lots that can't be saved unless we have something of this nature in place. Your comments on that, and if you can comment on TDC, the bank idea, we hear both sides. That's one. And if you can also maybe comment on the credit bought and sold, would it be the Board of Supervisors or a non-for-profit organization? Then if you do that, how would you audit and report maybe annually? Can you help us have a better understanding? If I may add one more thought on that, is the credit held by the bank are no longer real property, because that will give everybody the peace of mind they need to have. Can you package this comments and educate us?
They raise a number of important questions. I think community-based programs have their place, particularly when a local community can see the green belt, the farmland that they want to protect. I've often held for the last 10 or 15 years that doesn't work economically in many ways because the price of the land they're trying to save is very high. And therefore, it's going to take a lot of development credits to pay for that. I think it's going to take a lot of strength of this board to say, we do have to go back and deal with this countywide issue, realizing there's not a lot of people that are anxious to have the development. But unless this board hangs in there, we're not going to address that issue of the legal lots. I think the idea of a TDC bank is will work and be able to replenish itself by, you know, buying and selling credits. You buy low and sell high. To the degree a bank can go out and get independent funding, you know, that's the better. They can buy and not sell. But this essence of the bank as a private enterprise is they would buy low and sell high. Therefore, the bank really has to be an authorized agent of the board. You know, they're acting in your behalf. But I think that the way I've seen banks work before is that, frankly, you can capitalize it with a very small amount of money. The form one that we work with up in Cambria is the money comes from the state in a loan. It's a forgivable loan on a 10-year basis, but as a condition of that loan, the state requires that every lot that's acquired has to have their approval for the appraisal, has to have approval of escrow instructions, has to have an annual audit of the complete fund. You know, I think the county has that, should play that role in our local bank, to have that oversight and accountability. Again, I think my experience is the operator at the bank, if they're the buyer, does need to have some flexibility in making deals. You know, what are they buying, an easement? Are they buying a property, buying an easement? You know, how much does it cost? What are they really getting for it? The bank operator clearly needs to have a plan or a strategy in place that is exposed to the public. But really, it's only through an annual review and appraisal of how they're doing. Does it meet the rubber meet the road, so to speak? But I think since it's your money, it's your program, if it doesn't work, you can end it. Give us the money back. You know, it's easy to end. As a matter of fact, some TD programs should end. Up in Cambria, the purpose of the program was to save Fir Canyon. I think we just about done it. Give the money back to the state, end the program. But I think, well, there's fundamental change that I think is necessary. If it's really going to receive support from the public, we have to change the definition of what a credit is. And a lot of these things are possible if you change the basic principle that all TDCs are bought and sold from a bank. Frankly, a credit should be a legal lot. Then you as supervisors have a way to hold up your head and say, I'm actually achieving something. You know, I'm getting rid of a lot out there, I can see it, and I'm only paying for one lot up front. Now, to make money, the bank should operate on a real fixed fee basis. You know, somebody has to know how much it costs. Now, there are other proposals out there that say receivers should do appraisals, and I think that makes things very complicated. The rule is you have a fixed fee. How much does a credit cost? Twice what it costs the bank. Ideally, you can get rid of two lots for one, but there are costs associated with running a bank, the audits and reports, so it doesn't really work out that way. But I think there should be real simple, clear prices and strategy in place, you know, so that everybody knows that if you require a developer to purchase credits as a part of a general plan amendment, then go to the bank, get a layaway price, you know, nail down, go ahead with the amendment, you know how much it's going to cost. Those are just a few of the examples of how a bank can simplify the process considerably and still achieve a real measurable objective, because the bank is proceeding to buy lots according to a plan that people can see, rather than seeing sites being protected depending on which landowner comes forward at whichever time. You know, there's got to be a strategy in place. Hope that answered some of your questions. But I think putting those points down in writing maybe and getting people to look at them, and
yes,
we find out in short order whether there's agreement or not.
Yes, please, and I hope you don't have any long trips planned in the near future, because I have your phone number, and I want to talk some more about this.
Right. Thank you. I was also going to recommend, obviously, not to take any, not to take your willingness for granted as we move forward with a direction. I wonder, because Mrs. Knoll and Griffin have a lot of experience, and you have a lot of experience, if we were to bring something back, if you're willing maybe to oversee what's coming and simplify it and make this thing to happen for the good of the retiring some lots that are either environmentally sensitive or agriculture's being sending units or lots of that nature.
I'm happy to participate. Not taking any big trips. Not a mile
high.
Thank you. Kind of
Knowing that we don't have any money.
Thank you.
Help, but anyway.
And that, thank you. And that's on the record now. We're set. Bless you. Mr. Hill, followed by Joy Fitzhugh.
Thank you. Jesse Hill, a resident of Napomo, and been involved in TDCs for years. Sort of on both sides of the aisle, trying to fight and then trying to create a program that actually works, which is very difficult. But I think that what Mr. Belknap said is probably as close to the reality of this if you're going to continue with the program, and that is that you need to get out of the mode of thinking that it's going to be a free market system, get a bank, and have a single banker, and have county involvement with that. And I know those are two issues that have always been sort of the bugaboo of this, that it's always been sort of the free market program. But I don't think when you've got this kind of program that that's going to fly. It's just going to be too complicated, because developers hire people like me who go out and try to get a better deal. and that's just the way it is. And the appraisal process, I just don't think is going to work. I think you've got to have a banking system with a single banker, and you've got to have staff and county involvement to be able to watch this as it marches through the process. I think if you move in another direction than that, you're just going to have, you know, people coming in with proposals that are going to be very, very difficult to deal with on any number of levels. But that, you know, that just comes from experience with dealing with this on a one-on-one basis. I think you should obviously keep the Cambria program going. That seems to work. Napomo, that was created because, you know, we had so many problems in terms of getting the number of credits that were coming our way. We did that as sort of more of a protective mechanism than we did it for the idea of having a true TDC program. And I think that true TDC program goes back to those two sort of basic principles I was talking about before. And then the other one, and the most difficult one that you've got to deal with up front, because this is always one where you've got to turn the telescope around and look almost backwards, which is you have to figure out the receiving sites as well. I think it's just absolutely, once again, not going to work if you don't go to the single bank system with involvement from this board and or at least planning staff at the minimum. But at some level, you've got to deal with right up front, first thing on the agenda, where are we going to put it? Because as soon as you go into any community and you say, well, gosh, here we are, we've come in to break down your planning area standards, which is really the heart and soul of what a TDC does. You're going to add additional lots somewhere. You're going to create density. You're going to give some kind of bonus. Whenever you come to a community breaking down planning area standards, so that's the first thing you got to look at, figure out where they're going. Thanks.
Thank you, Mr. Hill. And Ms. Fitzhugh.
Good afternoon, Joy Fitzhugh, Sounds Farm Bureau. I did fax in my letter. I don't know if you all received it. I will pass it out then. I faxed it in because I was afraid I wouldn't make it to the hearing. So I was listening to you folks. I can agree with both what Mr. Belknap and Mr. Hill said. In my letter, I did emphasize we need a countywide program, not, and I'll drop down to my item 2, which I'm urging you not to support limiting the creation of new sending sites to only those areas within an existing community-based program area. If that were done, you would not have the protection of agriculture, the ability of agriculture to be a sending site, because most of them aren't going to be within a community-based existing plan. So I hope right off the bat you'll eliminate that idea. But I do want to urge you to support the bullet 3, which looks at the alternatives. The TDC Bank, I think, is as both Mr. Hill and Mr. Belknap said, is one of the directions for the solution. The other is the alternative uses for the TDCs, and in Appendix F of the Blue Ribbon Committee's final report, they have examples, and they also have a few of them in their report today, of alternative uses for those credits, and it doesn't have to mean density increases. So I think you really need to look at that. The TDC, as I have said probably ad nauseum, is only a small tool. It's not a cure-all. And so I'm just hoping that you folks will be able to continue with that. And I really appreciate both Cammie and Karen's work over the last 2 years with those of us on the Blue Ribbon Committee, and that we can work with the TDC to help with the sustainable development, to say sustainable growth program. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Fitzhugh. That and no further request to speak. We'll close it to public comment, bring it back to the board. Mr. Patterson.
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chair. Just a quick follow-up regarding staff's recommendation. I do support bullet point 1 under phase 1 simply because during the testimony and the hearings prior to today's meeting, both at the Planning Commission and at this board, the problems associated with the current TDC program, the idea was to put the brakes on the establishment of more credits until we can develop a program that does actually work. And I will back up and say the creation of new credits other than in the community-based programs, simply because we have an inventory of credits on the books that we need to find places to use those credits. And I do support staff's recommendation, again, under phase one, of generating some other uses besides creating additional lots for those credits so we can find a home for them while we are building a new program. Speaking now to phase two, I would like to see us move forward with generating a new program that will preserve agricultural lands, retire antiquated subdivision lots or parcels in the rural areas, and be more in harmony with the type of growth and development that we want to see here in San Luis Obispo County, and that is minimizing the rural subdivision type development and getting that development in more towards the urban areas where services and infrastructure are available. I'm again supportive of phase one as recommended by staff, and am supportive of moving forward with continuing a discussion about how we might reshape a program that truly does accomplish the goals that the original TDC program was set out to do.
Okay, thank you. Mr. Hill?
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chair. Pretty much echoing Mr. Patterson's comments, and to the certainly also with phase one and the importance of bullet point one. In phase two, what Mr. Belknap says I think is important too, and this was one of the difficulties that I had with some of the recommendations that came out of the original, or the not the original, actually there were several Blue Ribbon. The most recent committee was that it was so complex, and I think looking at a land banking idea that might simplify things is exactly what we need to do. And the retirement of these rural lots, I think, is really our main objective, though, of course, that would also, I think, bring in the preservation of ag land as well. So I would also support that land banking, something that is certainly simpler to use, that has a combination of some, and Mr. Hill spoke to this too, of some fixed fees or fixed rates, but also a certain amount of flexibility in how this could continue is where I'm at as well.
Thank you. Mr. Meacham.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I just need a little bit of clarity here, because if we're talking about limiting the creation of new sending sites, but yet we're trying to preserve agriculture, if you will, and if there's a lot of antiquated subdivisions out there, then why would you limit the ability to retire some of those antiquated subdivisions and not utilize them for a sending site?
I'll respond to that if you want. It's because of the way that the program is structured right now, you don't end up retiring enough lots. The way the program is structured now in the countywide sense, we use a particular divisor method that quite clearly produces more legal lots than it retires. So it's absolutely working against the fundamental goal of the program.
Perhaps I can jump in too. Phase one is really a holding pattern while phase two is being developed. So we wouldn't be prohibiting the creation of sending sites indefinitely. It would just really be prohibiting the creation of sending sites in this time period while we're developing the new program.
I see. Because I think that this is a I had a really lengthy discussion with Mr. Belknap. He knows more. He's forgotten more about this than I know. But this is another tool. It's like I feel like the ag clusters is another tool that we can utilize to preserve ag land, because at some point, these underlying lots that are out there, if we don't do something about those, we're going to end up with subdivisions. And so that's why I'm hoping that the Transfer Development Credits Program stays with these amendments. I can concur with these as another tool to be able to utilize the preservation of ag.
Absolutely another tool, but as Ms. Fitzhugh said it's not been widely used, but it has been clear in the manner that it has been used that it hasn't accomplished the goals. So from my standpoint, where we consider our phase one authorization, I would like it to be very clear direction to staff that in the phase one amendments are not just evaluating limiting the number. I think the direction is very clear. I for one, would like to see an ordinance come back that specifically does stop creating new sending sites except as connected with a community-based program. And since we're dealing with Title 22 in the inland area, the only community program that would then apply to is the South County Napomo program. So there is South Atascadero, but that South Atascadero is not a full community-based program. It doesn't have sending sites associated with it. What South Atascadero's community-based program really is a slight modification of the normal rules under which you make receiving sites there. And so that would stay in place. Their rules for how they would use TDCs in South Atascadero would stay in place. But I don't want anything in the direction to staff or the authorization of this amendment to suggest that we're going to be creating new sending sites in South Atascadero because they don't have a sending component within their community-based program. And Ms. Griffin, correct me if I'm wrong on that.
Well, that's true. Currently, they don't have a sending component. That doesn't mean that there couldn't be one in the future. You know, just thinking about the area, I can't think of some place that they might choose to have a sending site, but you're correct. They are really focused on the receiving end because that was really what was happening in that area.
So it really is, as I think we were just discussing, Supervisor Meacham, that this is a holding pattern, but in order to get a working program, it's fundamentally important that we stop creating credits in the manner that we have before. That moves on then to phase two. And let me say that I believe a transfer of development credit program or something equivalent is absolutely fundamentally important for us to achieve our goals under AB 32 and SB 375. We have enough legal lots in this county already. What we need to do is move those legal lots into the places which make sense relative to a sustainable community strategies program. Sustainable community strategy as SB 375. So I absolutely support an immediate analysis, as immediate as it can be, of land banking, of how that relates to ag land preservation, of how that relates to legal lot retirement in the rural areas. And we need to do some analysis. You know, some of the analysis has shown that antiquated subdivisions in some parts of the county are already developed to a point where saving them may not make sense, and we need to know that. We absolutely need to involve the cities in this, and I think that's probably the single biggest key to a successful program and at the same time a significant challenge. So with that as background, I'm fully supportive of what staff has brought forward. We have Supervisor Shajian.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Maybe a couple of questions for you. Since you said stop creating sending sites, I believe first time you mentioned South Atascadero. The second time, I believe you said maybe countywide. I want clearance on that.
Sure.
The reason I'm asking, if you were to stop that today, till we have something in place, if that's the purpose. What if, when you have agricultures that have legal lots and they were to come forward for the purpose of banking or doing something of that nature, are we then eliminating some kind of activity that we do support, if that's something we support? Or, because I heard you also say that, stop creating sending sites the way we've been creating them, and if those were not in compliance or not legal lots, I can understand that. But if there were legal lots, as we know, they exist within ag land and other areas, and the person or the landlord or the agriculturist chooses to bring that forward, why can't we address that while we're going through this process? And my last question was going to be for Ms. Griffin. Since we have an offer from Mr. Ray Belknap to come into the picture to simplify things for us and help us to create something of new TDC or under a new name or recognition or identity, how soon can that come forward? I know that we have other priorities, but at the same time,
here's something that can be a benefit rather than maybe it has received recognition in the past.
I can answer the second one first.
Why don't you do the second one first?
Okay. What we would do, because we did separate this out into two phases, is initially we would focus on getting phase one done as quickly as possible, bringing back those amendments to your board and having them adopted.
As quick as possible.
I would say 6 months at the earliest, that we would be back in front of your board with amendments ready for adoption.
That's for phase one.
For phase one. While we're doing phase one, staff can be talking with Mr. Belknap and other TDC experts in the state, and gathering some information. We can report back to your board just on the agenda, on board business time, just give you periodic updates on what we're learning. We could do those every other month, every 2 months, something like that, just to keep you updated on what we're finding out. And then at some point down that line, we would have enough information that the board then would be able to provide very specific direction to staff about processing the phase two amendments.
Where can we help to put Mrs. Knoll's experience with Cambria that's existing? Mr. Belknap's intelligence coming to the picture. Your experience with dealing with TDCs, why 6 months?
The 6 months to process the amendments is just a matter of there's certain mechanics that you have to go through, and it just takes that amount of time. We'll have to send out referrals. Referrals need to stay out for at least 30 days. We have to prepare an environmental review. The 6 months is on the assumption that we can do this with a mitigated negative declaration. Environmental documents prepared for ordinances are rather complicated to prepare. Then it also has to go through public hearings before Planning Commission before it can come to your board. So it's really just dominoes.
Yeah, thank you. It's a domino theory. And then let me respond to your question. I should clarify what I said. I have a very strong feeling we need to stop creating credits in the old way, except as they are related to the South County Napomo plan. And I'm talking inland here. Cambria's coastal, it's working well, may almost be done. So we need to stop creating credits under the old plan. We have some that we need to work through, some 40-odd that we need to work through, and we will. When we stop creating credits, another way of saying it is we need to stop creating sending sites, because it's the sending sites that create the credits. In terms of, so South County, Napomo seems to be working, the Napomo plan seems to be working, and if they see a reason to create credits, they have a workable banking system, right, and the whole thing that works. That's great. That is a success story that I want to see occurring. With the credits that we have, we need to honor the real property interest of the individuals who hold those credits.
Right.
And we need to apply them according to the way we do it now as receiving sites, or maybe some of the new ideas that would come forward that would help us absorb some more of those credits. But until we've worked through those credits, I think it's very much not in our interest to create new credits.
Right. I think my problem is when you say create, make something out of something that doesn't exist, rather than what I'm saying, that if there is a piece of property that's environmentally sensitive today, if there is an agriculturist today that has legal lots, existing lots, we're not creating lots. And if they want to bring them on the market for whatever reasons, to generate some income, to stay in business, or to whatever their choices are, why not allow them the opportunity? I mean, there is no rush. We have seen not much come forward. But if we put them on a stay as we speak, are we losing an opportunity that otherwise would have been something that's supported by this board?
My take on that is that we're paying too great a cost for trying to deal with that situation, and I'll tell you why. So an agriculturalist coming forward with multiple legal lots and a desire to preserve land, there are many other ways through conservation programs to go about getting that done. If that individual came through, let's just say there's a 1,000-acre ranch with 10 lots.
and that's not a far-fetched possibility. The problem with trying to address the retirement of those lots with our current TDC program is that we might create 20 credits or 50 credits or 100 credits because of the way that the program works now. So we have all those credits out there that then get added to the 40 that are already there that need to be absorbed someplace. In my mind, because of a structural flaw in the current ordinance, we simply have paid too high a price to get that 10-lot subdivision in the rural area retired. I want to retire that 10-lot. You know, if we have an agriculturalist who wants to consolidate that land, keep it in agriculture, pass it down, that's one of my fondest dreams in the world. That's why phase two is dramatically important now to get that moving. But I think we do ourselves a great disservice in trying to deal with that situation under our current system. It just doesn't work.
So for how long are we on a hold here?
Well, that's for us to hear back from planning, because to me, the execution of phase two is right at the core of those initiatives that we're trying to get going for AB 32 and SB 375. We need to start seeing how we can move development into the right places, and I would say that we're in probably a two-year hiatus likely before we have an up-and-running mechanism. I mean, and that's with Mr. Belknap breathing down our neck. I think it'll take a couple years to get the bank concept going and to be able to provide that tool again. I think it's much better for us to wait those 2 years than to try to process under our current situation.
Can we have a scenario where you have the 10 acres with 10 lots? And let's say they do have a buyer that lot for lot. Why can't we have some flexibility that something of that nature can be still considered in the majority rules?
Mr. Chairman, perhaps I can jump in. Actually, there's multiple methods for determining the number of credits on a sending site under the existing ordinance. And typically people have used the appraisal method because that's going to generate the majority of credits, where you appraise the value of the development that you're giving up and then use the divisor. However, in the existing ordinance, there is a method that uses underlying legal lots of record. It is a one-for-one. For every legal lot of record that you retire, you could get a credit. If there's some hesitation on the part of all the board about cutting sending sites off completely in this two-year, and I agree with you, Chairman Gibson, it is probably a two-year period where we'll be developing this other ordinance. You could have that existing legal lot method apply for the rest of the county in case somebody came along and wanted to make their site a sending site. Given that there's probably not a whole lot going in on the receiving side, I doubt that will happen, but it would offer that opportunity, and it is strictly a one-for-one, and we could just take away that appraisal method on the countywide level. It would only apply still in the South County.
Mr. Patterson, want to try if Mr. Hill would proceed before?
Okay.
I'm not paying attention to the lights anymore.
Sure. Thank you. I'm thinking back to the extended conversations that were had at the Planning Commission as well as before this board, and one of the issues certainly raised time and time again was the fact that the urbanized areas had not been consulted to establish appropriate receiving sites, and there just wasn't an opportunity to use the credits that were out there. And I have a question for Ms. Nall or Ms. Griffin regarding the last time we actually had an applicant for a sending site. I think it's been 6 or 8 years since we've even had anybody apply to use the program, and my concern, as Supervisor Gibson mentioned, is that we already have some 40 or so on the books, and the more we create, the less likely we are able to use the ones that Mr. Bonheim has had for many, many years, and we made the commitment to provide the opportunity at least for him to be able to utilize those credits, and that won't go away. And I just think that's really irresponsible in a way to generate more credits when we haven't been able to successfully use the ones that we have. I agree with Supervisor Gibson that the method that we use to determine the number of credits far outweighed the benefit. We retired fewer parcels than we created, and that's partially why we're in this predicament. And the real solution is moving forward with phase two, and that's creating a new program that follows the principles of the type of development that we want to have here in this county and truly works, and it brings everybody on board. And what I'm going to do just to move this along is I'm going to move to approve staff's recommendation for both phase one and implementing both phase one and phase two of the program.
I'll second. Just to clarify, though, are we needing to take two actions on this as the recommendation? County Council want to weigh in on that?
I think you could do both of them together
okay.
if you want to.
Yeah, I'll second with the comment that I also agree with Supervisor Patterson and Supervisor Gibson on being very clear that we need to put this on hold and not create any more credits, which would only create more, I think, more difficulties for us.
Okay. And was that your light comment as well?
Yes,
then
sir.
Supervisor
yes.
Meacham.
I guess that what I'm looking at, I can't support the first bullet point on that, but it appears to me that the phase two is something that should be more along phase one. I mean, we've talked about South County and the coast. Well, it appears as though the North County is where everybody's focusing all their attention on the development of these antiquated subdivisions and stuff. So I would assume that the mapping issue and the relationship between sender and receiver sites, the relationship between the communities, is essential before we can get anything else established. This seems like the phasing is reversed.
Right, with that comment, I'll just add that it would be my thought, and staff, this is an authorization hearing, so we will see your proposal as it comes back. I think we need clarity and we need simplicity in the phase one action. And I appreciate Supervisor Shadjan bringing forward that thought that there might be, but you know the reality of it is that I don't see that as a likely situation, and there are other methods of preserving a large ranch with multiple underlying parcels. So I believe we should stick with staff's recommendation on this bullet point one as they provided it to us. Look forward to their return with ordinance that's been these relatively quick and direct ones under phase one in a six-month time frame, and we thank you for that. With that, I'll call the question, and we'll take a roll call on it, please.
So you are authorizing the
process? We are authorizing, yes, please.
Thank you. Mr. Patterson?
Aye.
Mr. Hill?
Yes.
Mr. Meacham?
I don't know. I just don't support the first bullet point on this, but I support everything else, so I guess I have
to
say no.
Okay.
Mr. Asajian?
I know that there's a motion and second, and you're calling, and the argument can go both sides that we haven't heard anybody come to the market for the last 6 years, so what is the purpose of doing it or not doing it? The argument can go to both sides, and I just don't want us to miss any opportunities in case they existed. The 6 months I can support, the 2 years is a little longer than I care to see it happen, so... having taken those two at the same time, probably forcing me to a no vote rather than support the second recommendation rather than the first one. But see the direction it's going, I'll say yes.
So yes, okay, and Mr. Gibson.
Yes. Thank you. Planning staff on that. That said, we move now to closed session. I have one request to speak. Dr. Height.
Yes,
y'all to switch the green light, push the green button in so that the light will come on?
Dr. C. Height, Los Osos. Let me be blunt, and it's going to take a minute for this to come up, but this can get you sued. Protect yourself. Appearances matter. Eric Green's comments were proper. Accommodation and your 3-minute public comment. Accommodation and your public comments are not a shell game. It's a contractual agreement. When I deliver this to you, then you tell me that I'll be able to speak for a maximum of 3 minutes per item addressed during public hearing. And so when you treat the people of Los Osos differently and that different treatment is adverse, then you're giving them grounds to sue you. So, you know, please, when you look at about this accommodation and it says ADA, and yet it says 48 hours advance notice will be necessary to honor your request. Imagine coming to the boardroom and picking this up and seeing this. Imagine going to a restaurant and seeing the menu posted on the outside and finding out that the restaurant's going to demand that you give them 48 hours notice. This is illegal. Do something about it because you've got a bad history. Okay, see if I can get this there. You've got a bad history that you're going to have to address, and that is that I repeatedly asked the old board that you send your counsel and your administrator down before the budget hearings and have them overlook the updates of the ADA and the Under Civil Rights Act. And when your people from Los Osos come forward and they advocate for the people, renters and the low-income people, the senior disabled of Los Osos, they're advocating for fair housing rights. And when you interfere with these people, you're breaking a federal law. So here's the issue. You had a disabled veteran in this room, and you believed that you didn't have to be concerned about his housing accommodation, public facilities, or business. The county voted to undermine this man's rights, and nobody seems to know that this didn't pass. Well, at the time that the council and the administrator were urging the board to do this, they didn't find this online, and they also didn't find what I found online when I did research, and that is the attorney general sent notice to every county and said, prosecute, go forward and prosecute restaurants and businesses that aren't accommodating. But they didn't see that. They didn't find that. So, you know, I'm going to ask that you consider that you are responsible for in-home supportive services
and
that
Dr.
veteran was eligible for meal allowance.
Thank you, Dr. Hyde. Mr. Jensen, an estimate on closed session.
Yes, Mr. Chairman, somewhere between 1 and 2 hours, I'm guessing.
All right. Thank you.
I wonder what.
Yeah. Shall we convene closed session at 1:15? Would that work for you guys?
Sure.
And you'll just call.
And we'll call you.
I'll get it.